This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK10. And also by Zoe, the world's first personal voice companion, enabling Star Trek combadge-like interactions with Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, smart objects, and much, much more. To find out more about Zoe, visit xowi.me/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 116, The Dyson Sphere in the Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the release date for the Enterprise Season 3 Blu-rays, TNG Season 5 and Unification details, and the prospect of Star Trek returning to television. Plus, Larry gives us the lowdown on the Trekland trunk. Then in the feature, we're joined by Philip Gilfus and Daniel Prue to discuss the TNG episode, Relics. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Larry. It's great to have you back on the Ready Room with me, and actually the first time for you ever co-hosting with me the entire show. And I understand that you had a busy weekend at Disneyland searching for hidden Guinans. Is that right? All over the park, looking for hats everywhere?
we were doing that. I was going to say, I thank you for having me on to do this historic podcast, Chris, and you really don't have to drag up the name of dead sitcoms past when you say hello, Larry, but that's okay. No, we had a wonderful day. I had a mutual friend, a person I've got to know who occasionally throws a lot of niceness people's way, and we got to do a VIP tour of Disneyland, and which is not a huge behind the scenes, but just basically some nice places to go and getting right onto rides and that kind of thing. And didn't find any Guinans. Saw all kinds of hats, old and new. Guinans from any era, as it was. I started to say there was a Star Trek reference, but I guess I did one goofy Twitter about being captain on the steamboat. But
did you ask the Jungle Boat ride driver to raise shields when you went under the waterfall?
I didn't. We didn't do the Jungle Boat was one thing. I mentioned it, but that was one thing we didn't do. We went over to California Adventure, which we gave up on 12 years ago, and
I've been there once.
Got redeemed on a little bit. Yeah,
it's pretty good. You know, you posted a photo of that hidden Mickey, and I was thinking that you should be really good at that because you're accustomed to looking for the hidden 47s in Star Trek episodes.
Okay.
So, you know, hidden Mickey, it should translate over pretty well, I think.
Well, our host was a big on hidden Mickeys. Every 5 minutes was here's a hidden Mickey. There's one that's like, there's some outdoor tile, you know, concrete with little like flecks of stuff in it, large, you know, flecks, like eighth of an inch square type things. But one had a little tiny, about a 3/8 of an inch across Mickey head. In the side, like just totally random. It's like, okay, look down as you turn this corner and look down, there's a Mickey in this. Like, oh my God, guys, people really, come on. It was amazing. But
Well, I think at this point now, listeners are probably saying, I thought this was The Ready Room, a Star Trek podcast, but apparently I've tuned into The Tiki Room, a Disneyland podcast. So maybe we should go on to our Star Trek news now. And the first story that we have up is that we finally have a release date for the Enterprise Season 3 Blu-rays. They put out the trailer a while back, but they didn't give us any information about when it was actually going to be available, nor did they say anything about the special features. And we now know that it's going to be out January 7th of 2014. And this was the tricky part, Larry, and I don't know, maybe you might know a little bit more about this. In the trailer, they don't say anything about what the extras are. And when I went to Amazon a couple of days ago, when it very first had a date, I saw they listed a bunch of extras, and then I went back yesterday and all that information is gone once again.
I don't know. I haven't been, like I said, I've had my head in about eight of the things recently, including about to go shoot Star Trek Continues again. And I haven't been snooping around with the guys and powers that be. And sometimes it's not even about the producers. It's not about Roger and Rob Burnett or even Mike. And it's marketing and promotion people and powers that be and whatever. Or maybe that's all official, but it was supposed to be released next month. And so someone jumped the gun and put it up too early.
Yeah.
Or maybe it wasn't finalized or whatever. But there's a long list of things that were up. And it was cool to see some of the things. You know, the thing about Enterprise is they had started doing commentary tracks at the old StarTrek.com even. And some of that's been used in some places. And Enterprise is the only one of the series that's from the digital era, really. I mean, CGI had come into Voyager, but Enterprise wound up being a fully digital show. So a lot of things are easy to – it's like a no-brainer to pop it into Blu-ray. So a lot of this stuff is they can start from a further – they can start further down the field as far as the costs they have to put into the Blu-ray releases. And so there's – it'll feel like there's more bonus material on there. Since they're not having to put so much back into, I know there's an awful lot of those old physical models they've had to go build CGI models for. I'm totally kidding here. Since everything was CG, including the Enterprise itself.
With the commentaries, so some of these commentaries have been around since Enterprise was on the air, and they're pulling them out and they're putting them on the Blu-rays.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last year or two of, I mean, things had gotten so digital. That the old StarTrek.com with Mark Waid and Tim Gaskell, and that I got to work on a little bit. But the last couple of years of the series, they had upped the game enough to where they were recording. They would sit down with I know there's like Mike Sussman and I think Manny, and recorded a, because at the time Enterprise was on, audio commentaries for TV series releases were just becoming a big thing.
Right.
TV season box sets were becoming a big thing, much less commentaries on them.
It was about the same time that Ronald D. Moore was doing the ones for Battlestar Galactica as a podcast originally, and then those got put onto the DVDs.
So say we all.
When they came out. But he was like with a cigar and a glass of whiskey, like after the show was aired, and they were doing a podcast of BSG commentaries.
So say we all.
Well, it's like you go back and look at the film footage, say like on Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4, there's some filmettes, some previewettes, and very few people got to see those. They might have used those to fill up 5 minutes on a there might have been some show dedicated to film shorts. No one said, gee, you know, eventually we can have the, even in the tape era, if you added things to a movie, it was just going to be more tape. And how much do you want to put on a cassette? The whole digital concept of there is no bottom to the page. There's no, you know, there's no end. There's a given amount of bytes on a disc, but you're not going to take that up with a 2-hour movie or a few episodes or whatever. So all that stuff being there and being able to be repurposed in a new generation is great. And even just from 10 years ago, things were being done. And that's how new the whole damn field is. That they were pioneering, you know, people were just doing around, lumping around, doing fun stuff. And, this can be our, you know, first generation DVD, first generation Blu-ray can be an audio commentary. So it's fine. So some of these things I know were recorded for StarTrek.com just as a cool bonus thing. And bang, we're glad it's there, you know?
Yeah. Now, I think recently you were over at the studio recording for extras for the TNG releases and for Enterprise as well, right? Did you do anything for Enterprise season 3 or 4, especially anything that you can reveal anyway?
Well, it's I had gone in one time, like when they first started the Blu-rays for Next Gen, we went over and talked, but that was all about getting off the ground and pilot, and a lot of it wasn't so much I had been here firsthand as a witness, but I'd talked to people when I was doing the companion book. But as time went on and we got into late Next Gen, we haven't done Voyager and DS9 yet, but, you know, leaping to Enterprise since it's so easily done, converted to Blu-ray, we had front row seats for all of that. So, being here and doing communicator and doing fact files. So, I wound up doing two and three more sessions for the last half of Next Generation and for Enterprise. And, just talking about, you know, my impressions as a fan, but also as watching one foot in several different worlds. And yeah, watching that cast come together from the casting and watching the reaction and the whole saga of Enterprise and what it be. And this, you know, and we talked about it before, that the honesty, there's nothing to protect and nothing to hide with these.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. We think about, well, it's been 20, 25 years on Next Generation. Enterprise has only been 10 years, but there's no show to protect. There's no franchise. There's no production team to protect. There's no point in sitting on something. A lot of people are trying to set the record straight or fill in lost gaps in history and points that couldn't have been made, you know, when there people had to protect their hide a little bit or just the right. Normal, nobody writes and does tell alls for, you know, until some of the bodies are buried or some people can't be harmed. And not that it's that extreme in this case, but it's amazing. It's only been 10, 12 years and some of the raw edges are able to be talked about, starting with Rick and Brandon themselves. So we've had the first couple of
sets. Well, that's been a great one. And the honesty has been really fantastic. And hearing Rick and Brandon speak on the Enterprise Blu-rays so far, especially the season one Blu-rays where they have the in conversation sit down. And Kate and I were talking about this on Warp 5 this past week, actually. And I was curious your opinion as well. I feel like Rick and Brandon, especially Brandon, apologize for a lot of decisions that were made with Enterprise, and often in cases where I feel like they don't need to apologize for the decisions in the first place. And I almost feel like I get the impression that their mood has been beaten down over the years by the fan mm-hmm. reception of Enterprise.
Like they've been Will Wheaton'd over Wesley.
Do you think, is that an accurate reading?
It's been 5 years of an apology tour for Brandon especially. I think a lot of things, again, there's no ego and there's no franchise and no future job to protect. It's just kind of like have a clean slate and then let's see, you know, who the hell knows what the future will bring? There's no such thing as never say never. And all these people talking about next series and who would do it and all the veteran guys that I wish a new series would get trusted, you know, Ira or Ron or you know, even Brannon, you know, Brian Fuller, all these Trek vets who you know can write Trek and or a lot of them we don't even know what they were capable of because they had to submit. They weren't a showrunner. And I know good and well a lot of choices and instincts they wanted to follow through on still had to get massaged and still had to answer to Rick's final word. And what's been refreshing about Rick, as far as having him say, gee, there's things I wish we had been able to do differently, is the whole unseen story of what he was putting up with the network, which went there's choices Rick made on his own that he could have answered to. And I think he's gone back and reviewed some of that. But there's an awful lot that he, being an old guard TV person, he wasn't going to dish on his network. Now we go back to the original case here of Gene all through the 70s trying to get Star Trek back at all and was always ripping on the censors and the ratings and all that. And it's been really interesting. Here's after all these years and all the different people talking about the original series case, Mark Cushman's books, where he actually finally just, he couldn't get them, he couldn't borrow them, and he couldn't do them as a researcher. He finally just licensed and did a business deal to get the Nielsen ratings. And you go in and you find that Star Trek, the original 60s Trek, was winning the time slot or coming in second. It wasn't, NBC at the end didn't dump on Star Trek because of bad ratings. They just got pissed off at Gene being a rebel or pushing the envelope on his stories. Or they would say, do this, do that, don't show the kiss, don't do that, don't refer to, you know, whatever subject matter. And he would kowtow to 10% of it, not all of it. And they just got more and more, even as some of them loved the show and would yell to do more planet shows, but then they would yell about spending so much money that they would have to do a bottle show. I mean, all the incongruities of all that and why he, with Next Gen, he didn't want anything to do with the network. And between not getting the deal and just realizing that they could go pioneer a syndicated network of their own making and going with that way, and that's what was driving him then, you see what that show network relationship could be like. And so here's Rick, who came up, who was an independent producer and won his Emmy on Children with the Big Blue Marble and had a career in film and TV. And he was the studio guy with Next Gen, and that's what his background was. And then here, the whole Trek revolution happens, and Enterprise, and he's got the pressure of carrying on the mantle of the franchise. I mean, I will never forget when Nemesis and Enterprise were both being developed at the same time. I could tell. I was amazed at how it's like no one cared about Nemesis as far as keeping the secrets and holding tight to everything. It was Enterprise. It was like he knew that the future of the franchise was more weight on Enterprise than on Nemesis. And I think with Stuart Baird directing Nemesis and taking it to heart, for right or wrongly, and more of the latter, taking it as it's a director's medium and I'm in charge. And I think it was easy for him not to fight those fights and just concentrate on Enterprise and be hyper secretive about it and hyper worried about getting it launched and having it be fresh and not having it feel like one more trip to the well, his famous phrase he always said. So then for all of that guy that seemed to take all that down and be the punching bag for fans, and sometimes rightly so, but to then turn around and be talking about these network interactions and what kind of, I mean, I knew some of that with Voyager. I didn't know as much. I knew some of what happened with Voyager happening in its early stages and why it turned so fast, but and went vanilla in my eyes. Tons of Voyager fans love the show. I'm not knocking it, but I'm just saying what the pilot did to the production run, and as opposed to how Enterprise was when it launched. And there were a lot of things he was saying that I wasn't aware of, that he had just. He was the good soldier and wanted his show to stay on the air and didn't get into all the dirt. And to hear a lot of that, you're kind of going, oh, okay. And I don't have the feeling that he's trumping all that up to make himself look better or to be a martyr. I totally have no doubt.
Yeah, neither do I.
The kinds of things. Yeah. Part of the reason was because UPN, the network, was such a stupid little rinky-dink network. And they would change, and their administration would change over. I mean, look at the other shows they were putting on. And Enterprise was like
Platypus
a golden,
Man.
Was a good, yeah. Yeah, and I just remember Gates McFadden was so in a tizzy about being in her new show, and they rejiggered the shooting schedule of All Good Things,
right?
As a help for her, and it complicated because of all the future, the past, and the present, and how to produce that with sets and costumes, and they totally laid they threw poor Rick Colby a bone on all that, and as you know now, and no, they didn't throw him a bone; they threw him a monkey wrench. And you know, Marker, that was her series, and she was so, because that's what you do. You the minute your hit show is going down, no one cares in Hollywood what you're doing now. They or what you did last. They need your. And she was so into that track of needing to have her new show on, and then you know, but Marker was like a. There were some good shows on UPN though. Not to get off on this too much, and I know we are, but so yeah, so it's been refreshing to me. Rick Brannon over apologizing, maybe so a little bit.
Maybe I feel like so. He does a little bit. I feel like they both felt a bit beaten down by the fans over the years, but now there seems to be this resurgence. Fans discovering Enterprise, watching it on Netflix, and they're feeling better about it. And so, hopefully, that's going to be a bit more of an upbeat mood. But the extras have been fantastic, and the only thing that
it was very cool
seems
having
to be for sure.
It was cool seeing the reunion, even though it's only been less than 10 years, and you're talking about the reunions of the Next Gen cast. But, you know, it's time, the generations and the social compression and the technological compression of things is happening faster and faster and faster. So, yeah. And you never know what's going to happen to somebody, God forbid. So, yeah, have a reunion after 8 years or whatever. Go for it. I had this conversation with Doug Drexler on an interview on my site on Trekland about the campaign to get the Facebook campaign to have Netflix do a season 5 of Enterprise. It wouldn't be that expensive and it'd be ready, you know, and Doug talking about how there's been a whole generation of fans that don't know they're not supposed to hate, that don't know they're supposed to hate Enterprise. They weren't there on the week to week. There's a lot of people just watching it going, well, this is cool. And he says,
they don't
know they're supposed to hate it. So it's all fresh and good for them. So, you know, yay.
So we'll learn even more about what's going up. We've got season 3 coming up again, January 7th. Season 4 will follow, my guess, probably somewhere like, I don't know, April or May, given the release schedule that we've had so far. That's just a guess. And as far as featurettes, the only thing that I can tell for sure that seems to be on these discs is the temporal Cold War declassified. I know Brandon had mentioned them wanting to have writers, getting all the writers together to talk about the temporal Cold War. So maybe that will be on there. Of course, there's going to have to be a good bit of stuff about the Zindi on here because season three is the Zindi arc. And then there are commentaries with David A. Goodman, Chris Black, Connor Trenier, Andre Bermanis as well, Manny Coto, and Mike and Denise doing their text commentaries, which they've been doing for quite a while, going back to the Fan Collective sets. So,
and I'm going to be real quickly. I'm really glad to see Chris Black being a part of this, because I think in The Squeeze, Chris Black came in about midway through season one, and he was an original series fan. He was an old Trek fan. And so by the time you get to Enterprise, you've got Chris and Mike Sussman and Andre and David Goodman and Manny. And all of these, you know, you've gone full circle from, gee, we need a fan and the writers to keep us on track and not do boners that the fans are going to groan about, to the whole damn staff is very competent professional TV writers who also happen to be Star Trek fans. And just in the squeeze of things, because when Manny got bumped up to showrunner for the last season, it was when Chris left and then David left. But I'm glad to see them a part of this and in the mix, and because they had an awful lot of contributions, and they really wanted the show to go be what it became eventually, and weren't always in a place. They weren't the right guy at the right time to be able to do what they wanted to do where Manny was. And I'll leave it at that. But you know what I'm saying? If they could have done what Manny was able to do later on, we would have seen a different show earlier than we did see.
Yeah, right.
Beefing it up. Yeah. And having it be that show leading into the original series that fans thought it was going to be.
That's the key. Yeah. Like, I don't know if one would be better than the other, because I like the first two seasons of Enterprise. But I do think that fans in general were expecting more of what we got in season four. That's what they were expecting from the show.
And not the fact that every single, and Manny said this too, not the fact that every single episode would be this obvious tie-in to an original series show.
Right.
Manny's point was, by that time, they had 18 slots left, and he didn't have a lot of time to fix a lot of, you know, fix the Vulcans, talk about this, talk about that. So it was kind of, if he'd had 4, 5, 6, heaven forbid, 7 years, you wouldn't have had that feeling of, you know, if you weren't an original series fan and you were going, oh my God, does every show have to, which seems ridiculous to say, but there might be somebody out there saying, and just for creativity's sake, you wouldn't, you know, you would like the variety to be able to do that. But you would have seen a lot of that, and you would have seen more breathing room for some things to, you know, and the show to pioneer its own stuff that we didn't know already from, or lead into something obvious and build within itself,
right,
more like the other show.
Well, we'll see what Chris Black has to say on his commentary and everything else when this comes out. And then also TNG season 5 is going to be coming out November 18th for the UK, November 19th for the US and Canada. German release date is unknown as of yet. And also accompanying that release, just as we had with season 4 and we had Redemption, we're going to have Unification, the feature length Unification on Blu-ray. And how do you feel about these feature length releases, Larry?
Well, they're cool. I know if nothing else, I have a kind of a skewed slant because I got to go in and sit and do documentaries. I know part of what was driving that was originally everybody loved seeing, or everybody, the idea of having Best of Both Worlds together as one piece was interesting. And that way you got to have part two, because they were always cliffhangers. You had to wait 6 months to have, and they thought that was awkward. So they wanted people to have a whole piece together. Now I know some people, especially Best of Both Worlds, felt a little cheated, because you almost want to, I don't know what new fans watching it for the first time think, but people that were felt disappointed that you didn't have that Mr. Worf fire, da-da-da-da-da-da, to be continued agony moment. You can't recreate that now and know what that's like to wait 3 months. I mean, that's kind of, but even just to have it there as a nod to your memory of watching it, you know.
Maybe they can have like a bathroom break in the middle. Run, get some popcorn, go to the bathroom,
come back. Go restock your Diet Coke Splenda or whatever. But so that's not quite as much a burning issue with you know, Redemption and all the rest, Unification. And Unification wasn't even a season cliffhanger. Now, I know that the guys, you know, if they carried the pattern over of season ending cliffhanger / openers, that people aren't as enamored of Time Zero
or Descent either.
Or Descent, yeah. And they were looking more, not so much being about the cliffhanger shows as just the two-parters that were really cool. And I think Unification was kind of a no-brainer since it was Leonard. Although, yeah, as we said earlier, or as I think we, as I've said before, and I think we may bring up again, that I know Michael was disappointed in his own script for Unification. But apparently, this is a surprise to me, and I haven't been snooping around enough. I'm so thrilled to hear they've gotten Jerry Taylor to talk about Unification. She did the novelization of Unification, and that was when I was first coming out to LA and working on The Companion, and it was only fourth season by phone and fifth season live that I got to start meeting these people. And Jerry was still flushed and exhausted from having written the novelization for Unification for Pocketbooks on top of still doing her showrunner job, you know, during the day. And she was like, yeah. And they had, she had a copy, they had taken the book art spread out with the, you know, Spock and the very historic Spock and Picard and Data art from that cover. And she had, they had signed it and framed it and given it to her as a little special gift when her book came out. Because back then it was still also rare for anybody involved with the show to be doing anything with the novels, with Pocketbook, even a novelization. Now it's happened a lot more since then. But at the time, that was kind of historic for someone on the writing staff at the shows to have done that. And I hope she talks about that too. That's part of the whole thing. She got to add for, you know, now we think of, well, if a creator wrote it, it's a hair more toward canon comfort factor than, you know, not.
Right.
So I hope she gets in that too. But I was very excited to see that because Jerry's been retired and she's in her 70s and dealing with she's retired from the industry in LA and up north in Northern California and enjoying, she directs some community theater when she can, and she and her husband are up there both retired and hasn't had a lot to do with Trek. Not that she's running from it, but she's like, you know, let the young kids have them. God bless them. I've you know, I've talked to you, Larry, for a million times. I've talked to everybody over the years. Everybody knows all there is to know from me. And of course, that's not true. Everybody always wants, there's always more that you can put in. And so I was, anyway, that's going to be a highlight for me on that release is, as much as I know Jerry, I know what she has to say. Just, I'm thrilled that the new generation will hear her voice. And what I said about Chris Black a minute ago, times 100 on this, because Jerry did so much for the latter years of Next Generation and empowering the women characters and older characters and, you know, and all that. So I'm excited to see this. I know Rob Burnett was worried about the later years being too calm and peaceful, but I think once they get into it, there's plenty of texture there.
There's plenty of stories to tell. That's one of the great things about the standalone two-part discs is that they are giving you additional material that you wouldn't get on the sets.
Right. So, I meant to say that. It's wonder, more capacity. Yes. It's more space
some
to talk
wonder,
about.
Why am I going to buy it as a standalone disc when it's already going to be on the sets? But, you know, there's more special things there. And I mean, in a way, it's, you know, it could be a money grab in some sense. They could just put all that on the sets. But then again, they have more, if they can devote their attention to the single episode, they can give you a more focused experience. So I think it's a good thing. So
well,
watch,
you know,
for that coming out.
I'm glad for that. That's still continuing, even though they're not doing the standalone movie events with Fathom after the first.
After
the first three seasons. They got into some, there was some discussion about the way the rights, not rights, the residuals and royalties came off of even though they'd said that they were non-profit.
Oh, is that what happened?
All the profit went to the Red Cross. It was set up front. They didn't make a big deal out of it, more because they didn't want to look like they were, it wasn't they were trying to keep it a secret. They were trying not to look like they were doing it for the sake of the Red Cross PR. Like, oh, look at us. Aren't we special? We're giving our profit on this event to, I mean, it was really meant to sell the DVD. The event itself wasn't meant to be another Moneybags event. And Fathom covered their costs and paid their people as a vendor person that CBS went out to hire. But if there was any extra money, and Best of Both Worlds was a huge success, which was, you know, if you could survive having Data Lore and Where No Man's Gone Before, if you had enough money on that night to go on to having, you know, there was all the buzz with The Measure of the Man and the restored scenes, and that was a big buzz night, and then you knew that, oh, they have to do this for Best of Both Worlds. And so, yeah, it wasn't the fact that it wasn't a popular event and they didn't make money on it, even though the profit was going to the Red Cross. It was, there were some questions about, even though there weren't any, but the fact that the questions even came up was enough to have them go, okay, fine, you know what, let's just not mess with it if it's going to make some people unhappy or edgy or whatever. So
Yeah, it's
so
too
that's
bad
why
that's
the,
how
that's
things
where the
work,
events but... went away. Yeah, I was really sad to see that. But
that's curious. I had not heard that. I was wondering why they had not done
with
more
the guilds
because they had
things.
Been so successful.
Yeah,
yeah, before that. So,
but the fact that they're proceeding along with these standalone releases, even without the, shows that what the thing that was driving it wasn't the event; it was the having it as a release. So,
yeah, exactly. So we'll watch for these again. November 18th for the UK, November 19th for the US and Canada. We don't know yet for Germany. They're apparently for the UK. I found this interesting. They did the same thing with Redemption. There's not going to be a UK release of Unification. So those of you in the UK will have to order it from the US. And of course, it will play just fine in your Blu-ray player. And I found it especially odd because it appears that we are getting a Japanese release of Unification. I've even seen it has different cover art than the one in the US.
It always does for Japan.
Uh-huh. Well, no, but it's the same style as the Redemption cover. It looks like it was done by the same designer, same artist.
It probably was, yeah.
But the American Unification cover is very different from the Redemption cover. So
well, that's really odd about the UK because I know for a fact that you folks in the UK can go to Amazon.UK to get your Stellar Cartography copy and you don't have to come to the United States and Amazon. Oh, did I just slip that
it
in?
Is,
oh, wow.
It is odd. It was a bit odd. So, but anyway, I'm glad these are coming out. So we'll watch for those and have them in our hands soon. So Larry, let's take a quick break from our news discussion here and introduce a new sponsor on the show. And this sponsor is Zoe. And Zoe it's a very interesting thing for Star Trek fans because it's a device that takes us a step closer to the comm badges worn by Starfleet officers in the 24th century. Zoe bills itself as the world's first personal voice companion. And it has similarities to the Bluetooth devices that we're beginning to see as companions to smartphones. But most of what we hear about these days are smartwatches, for example, which are on your wrist, or Google Glass, which, of course, had to be inspired by the Vorta in Deep Space Nine, right? That little thing flipping around right there.
Yeah.
So it's like wearable stuff is coming to the forefront, but it's mostly your wrist or on your face. But what Zoe is Zoe is actually a wearable badge, which is ideal for quick voice interactions. So for example, you could give Zoe a command like turn off AC, traffic conditions, turn on the porch lights, read my Facebook messages, play music by Miles Davis. I'm sure Riker would love that. Mm-hmm. Or for our listeners, play the Ready Room because it taps right into your podcasts as well. And I'm not sure about this, Larry, but I haven't heard yet if Get Me Cetacean Ops is an option, but maybe Commander Flipper could write a voice module to make that possible, because one of the great things about Zoe is that while it works with many, many services right out of the box, self-service interactions with Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, smart objects and such, Zoe has voice modules which open it up for third-party developers to tie into the badge. So it's very extensible. It's very much like an open source thing here, unlike Siri, which is, of course, closed off as an Apple product. So, you know, Commander Flipper, he could tie you into Cetacean Ops if he wants. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be a great addition.
Yeah, faster than lightning.
But so basically what Zoe does is it enables person-to-person communication without phone calls. And of course, the self-service interactions that I just mentioned with social media, Spotify, and so forth. It also comes with a companion app that's available for all the major platforms. So not only iOS, but also Android, Microsoft's Windows Phone, and BlackBerry. And Zoe is currently a product that's under development, and you yourself can help make Star Trek-like comm badge technology a reality by visiting their website to find out more information. And then in early November, Zoe is going to be kicking off a Kickstarter campaign with the goal of raising $100,000 to further development. And there will be different donation levels that you can make, just as there are with any Kickstarter campaign. And those who donate will be able to reserve their own Zoe for a special price of $149. Now, there will be more incentives to come in the coming weeks, and we'll let you know what those are as they're rolled out. But for the time being, you can find out much more about Zoe, and you can see photos of the device by going to zoe.me/trekfm. So that's www.zoe, and that's spelled X-O-W-I.me. M-E. And be sure to include the Trek FM portion of the URL when you visit so that Zoe will know that you heard about it here on Trek FM. So go check this out. It's really cool. And it's going to get us one step closer to Star Trek's 24th century comm badge technology.
That's incredible. The fact that they're doing that and then they're using the Kickstarter to get people involved. Yeah, just to get it further on down the road. And it's a good thing you spelled that out, because otherwise I thought we'd ventured into a Firefly podcast here. But no, that's interesting. X-O-W-I. Yeah.
Yeah.
And not Zowie as in, you know, Adam West and 60s Batman, but Zoe, X-O-W-I.
That's right.
Very cool.
So, Larry, you have a thing of your own going on right now, too. And this is called the Trekland Trunk. I know all the stuff you've got there in your office and all the boxes and loads of stuff that you've got there. I'm not sure that all fans know just how much stuff you have in your possession. And you've put together the Trekland Trunk to help unload some of this stuff and give fans a chance to get their hands on some very rare collectibles. What can you tell us about the Trekland Trunk?
Yeah, well, basically, I've gotten, you know, a lot of things I've just collected over the years for... I have a very small... I've always been very conscious about not having just a lot of stuff. Like having... There's lots of fans that have 40 billion ship models and action figures and whatever. And, you know, autographed pictures. And that's all cool and well. That I've always tried not to go that direction because... a lot of my stuff I have is reference material and archival things. I have my little McCoy collection and that kind of thing. But and some things I just grabbed onto and thinking, well, I may need this eventually down the line or whatever. And I go ahead and take. And now that we have, you know, digital and scanning capacity, a lot of what I've been trying to do the last few years is shrink my bulk down and do that. But also realizing that when I have set plans or, you know, a lot of things with communicator and FAQ files and all this stuff that I've had to have copies of and all that, it's piled up and it's been great resource to have. But my value has always been for the information, not as a collectible, really. So in trying to shrink the bulk down, yeah, I want to be able to share it with people. And then at the same time, I really don't want to be, Huckster Jr. And I have my different, my Trekland blog and my page and my Trekland Facebook page. And I didn't want to litter all that with, hey, go to eBay and see this, you know, first draft of Caretaker, or, hey, I've got a, you know, set plan from, I don't know, some DS9 show or whatever, or something odd off the wall. And I thought, well, hey, there are some people that love this kind of stuff. And there are a lot of people that really don't want to be bothered with it. So I will just something as simple as a Facebook page to go over. Really, you're just registering your interest. And I will just put notes up over there. Hey, this is on eBay now. And if you want to hear about it, you're there, you'll get it. If you don't care about that, then you won't be bothered by it. And I've had people go, what do you mean be bothered by it? Well, I know. I hate having things thrown in my face. If I'm on somebody's page and they're doing this on the side, I mean, I always try to be very – even things I believe in, like our Kickstarter for Star Trek Continues, or when I'm asking people to donate for the Con of Wrath, because that's the kind of time we live in. Nobody does anything, keeps it secret, and then springs it on the world. Everybody knows everything from square one, and they know if it doesn't get off the ground, they know it was out there. So, you know, there's plenty of actors and directors that have been in that boat. So, so this is one way I thought would be cool to use it. It's like, fine, go over here. And so that's all it is. It's no big deal. It's no money. It's no nothing. It's just a list. And if you're on, if you have liked the Trekland Trunk or even the Twitter at Trekland Trunk, you'll get a note that so and so is on eBay now. I may even try to use the message thread on Facebook and just if I know something is really limited and say who would be interested in this. And if I got 8 or 10 names, I did a beta test with this a few months back. If I get 8 or 10 names, I may just pull everybody together in a private thread and just let everybody kind of bid. Rod Roddenberry did that when he had a few things from his collection when he was starting to shut down his mom's house and before they sold it. And it was right about the time of the Haitian earthquake and hurricane. And he wound up everything he made, he gave to Haitian relief. But they would just, instead of going to eBay and having more money go into the eBay fees, they would just have a thread on Facebook and people would bid on something. And then when the thread gave out, you know, and it was on the honor system that you wouldn't you know, bail out of your bid. But if somebody did or something happened, they would just step back to the next bid. But it was very public. And I don't know if everybody's – it was kind of a fun freewheeling thing, but I don't know if everybody's, you know, comfortable with that. So if we did that, it would be something that was really limited, and I would just do it over on a private message thread and pull those people in and do it. But otherwise, it's just a place to do that. Right now, people can comment back. I didn't want to take it away from putting the notes up. So I may have it where people can just post comments if they want to, on, you know, just come in and post out of the blue on there. But for right now, it's just a kind of react to me. And I was going to start posting things when I got to 50 or 60 people or so, and it's up to 250, and I've got people going, hey, when are you going to put something up?
Yeah. I see, so it's up to 239 now. So
yeah, I've got about, I don't know, 60 or 80 on Twitter last time I saw. So mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I was trying to get this done before we had the continue shoot, and I need to get up to speed on eBay because I've really not ever done eBay. And I do you know right off if the sale, are they always like weeks? Is it a 7-day sale, or is that configurable, or do you know?
The only thing I really know about eBay is the Weird Al Yankovic song eBay.
Yeah, I used pink bathrobe, a rare mint snow globe, a Smurf TV tray I bought on eBay. My house is filled with this crap.
So I don't know much about the actual service itself.
Well, maybe we can have a caller call in tonight and let me know. Oh, no, wait, we're not on live radio.
I understand there's a lot of bubble wrap involved.
Yeah. So not to sound like a complete dweeb, but I've got to do my, you know, I've had a lot of things pile up here, and I was trying to racing along, trying to do an awful lot. Here in the next day or so, if it's not there. But the point is, if you just go like the Trekland Trunk Facebook page, then you'll know as soon. And if I don't get something rolling now, when I'm back around November 4th, November 5th, we'll get some items up there. I'll start with one or two or three things, just baby steps, and see. But that's it.
Now, one question about it. Gates McFadden, of course, it's become very popular recently that she had in storage, she had 1/8 Beverly. Mm-hmm. Is there a 1/8 Larry hiding in the Trekland trunk?
Oh, I wish. I don't know. Yeah, you know, if somebody in my family had put one aside, I don't know. No, that's funny. Although, you know, now that they've got the make yourself up as an action figure.
I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Look, it's a
send yourself.
Oh, those are a little bit bigger than Playmate, so that would be, you know, like a 1/6 Larry or something. Yeah. No, I would. No, that's hysterical. It's mainly paper goods. I am going to have some. I know we'll have. I've got first drafts of a few as old as. I have a first draft of Tapestry and a first draft of Relics. I have several DS9 mid-range, like second season, third season, second drafts. But I've got a set of the of Caretaker and Emissary early drafts, so you can see an evolution. But I've got a lot of – I had some people just give me DS9 set plans that they drew light plots on. So if you're a DS9 fan, you know, be looking for that. I've got – what's scary is this move has really brought out that I've got – I've put things away that I didn't even – I'd forgotten I had. So, you know, not, I don't have chunks of – I've had some things in auctions over the years. I do have some Akutagram paste-up boards back where they had to paste it up out of paper and then shoot it as a negative. And so late next generation, early DS9 era, you know, computer monitor screens, the actual paste up board, one of a kind. Those will be turning up, and some promo items. I realized I had three invitations to the opening night gala of the experience. You know, so if you're, hopefully maybe even some things that aren't high dollar that I just want to have a good home, and maybe some things that won't be so expensive for people to have too. So some big and little bits. So, so there you go. You know, no captain's chairs. No.
No captain's chairs.
No captain's
chairs. No
giant
chairs. Ears from Rathacon on a board. No, nothing like that. Okay.
No, nothing like that. But I do have some season sets of Enterprise scripts that are going to go. Like, I'll box them up as first season, second season, third season. But a lot of this, I've got things that I'm digitizing and scanning them, so I have the information. If I need to use it for later on, I've got it. Yeah. But the bulk of the paper is going away. And that's not to say, again, that everything's a paper item, but there you go. So, yeah. So I hope nobody's gone the other way and thought, oh, my God, he's going to be unloading. You know, he's secretly stashed the torpedo room bay set from Next Generation or something. No, it's not. But there you go. Yeah, I just the main thing was I wanted to find things a good home, and I didn't want to be used car salesman on my sites. So there you go. Yeah. If you like that kind of thing, go over and like it. And like
all
it.
Right, cool. So all the stuff that you have, Larry, comes from the past Star Trek television series. And the last item we'll talk about in news today is this tweet that's been going around. And I don't so much want to talk about it because I think there's anything to it really myself. It's kind of one of those things that gets misconstrued and blown out of proportion. But I did just want to get your thoughts on the topic.
We are talking
and this
about
is
the
this
interwebs.
Tweet.
Yeah.
This is this tweet that was tweeted by Joe McCaldzuk, I may be mispronouncing the name, a British reporter, who had picked up something that Roberto Orsi had said, and he tweeted, Bob Orsi just told me they've had a meeting with CBS to revive Star Trek on TV. This made me very excited. And I guess the deal was that Orsi was over there doing an interview it was an Ender's Game junket, I guess, and he was talking and he was doing this interview, and Joe works for Sky News.
Because as we all know, nothing is ever said about Star Trek unless it's at a junket for something else.
Exactly. And this set off the rumor mill and the firestorm and all this stuff. Like, oh my gosh, you know, Bad Robot is talking to CBS. They've been having behind-the-scenes meetings and a new series. And I don't think that's what it is at all. And Orsi himself, I believe, told people that it got blown out of proportion.
With a post and
go listen to my talk with the guys at Mission Log, and we talked about it there in more reasonable terms. So, but what I wanted to ask you, Larry, was just what do you think about the potential of Star Trek returning to television, maybe for the anniversary year, 2016, for the 50th anniversary year? Do you think does this have any legs?
Well, there's two or three bits to this. Number one is, we keep hearing different things. People mention exactly, to begin with, what is the legal contractual framework between when the Viacom split happened, the Viacom divorce, I call it, between Paramount and CBS, what was said about it in the bedrock of that agreement. Then within a year, the deal with Bad Robot to produce the first movie, and were there additional protections made for the movie on top of that, which I think we've all heard about. But even before there was a movie, the fact that it was Bad Robot and J.J. Abrams' team doing the movie, even just the basic divorce between this and the fact that the mom and dad fought over the baby Star Trek, and I think I've said this before, CBS got major custody, but dad Paramount gets to do a movie every 3 or 4 years, you know, have it visit. And all the, how that shook out, and it was a crazy thing. I don't think nothing has ever been done like that before. The idea has never come up. There's never been anything that big like Star Trek to be done. And the way they had to handle syndication and future DVD, you know, / Blu-ray sales and all those kind of, the fact that all licensing went to CBS. There is no Paramount licensing right now anyway. But the fact that movies weren't dealt with through licensing on Paramount's at all, that set up all kinds of weird little hurdles that have since played out that people didn't even see the beginning. But exactly what the agreement is, we know that Paramount is paying CBS some kind of token fee a year to not do a series, but that's part of a larger agreement of what's going on. And then we know that J.J. Abrams wanted to have some protection for the movies and a little less confusion. And I knew at the time how that was playing out in other ways. And now we've had the stories come out about really he wanted to leave the old series behind, everything about the old, you know, 40 years behind, and focus on the new, and had that also, you know, trickle down to all the products and merchandise and all the tie-in, everything. and CBS balk at that. So anything going forward, whether it's Bad Robot involved or anybody, there's some bedrock things involved there. Now, then you get to what do the guys with suits and money even want to put money into, and the whole perception of, as it was in 05, do we need to let Star Trek rest? Is the audience tired and wiped out? Which I think the answer is resounding no, they're not. That the wrong perception got out there. That Star Trek wasn't tired. I think the producers were tired. And there, you know, the rise of fan films and everything else has happened. So part of this is like, who would, we're still back to square one as far as who would do it, what would the conditions be, and all that. And I think a lot of people, and there's an inertia here. No one is in charge of Trek. And when there's an inertia, there's no one at the helm of it to push it, and no one knows who to let go with that. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Lots of people would like to. We've had stories about well-known people and unknown people pitching stories. And there are meetings that happen where somebody – and, you know, there are smart people at CBS that know that this is eventually going to happen. Whatever the legal strictures are and whatever is going on, there will come a day when – somebody pivots and they're ready to do it. It may be based purely off a relationship. It may actually be with the value of a story someone has pitched to somebody. And it may not just be who did the who, what producer, writer did the pitching. It's who they did it to. And did that person who heard it now get promoted up to a position where they can do something? You know, it's just the way all that works out. So what's amazing about this last thing, it's because it's Bob Orsi and he's tied into, you know, and Bob Orsi and Alex Kurtzman have their own company, KO whatever it is, KO Limited or whatever, Enterprises. And they are in JJ's team at Bad Robot, but they're not employees of Bad Robot. They have their own production, whatever. And so just because they might be working on something does not mean it's JJ involved, although they may do the JJ universe, or they may go back and do a Prime, or they may do something, as we used to say, they may do something completely different. So, but other people have been having those meetings too. And sometimes they're, you know, like Brian Fuller has talked about wanting to, or, you know, there's a mention of you're at a party and you mention something to a well-connected person. It's like playing golf in the business world, you know? It's like you say something on the golf course. All those kinds of things happen occasionally from people that have a vested interest or people with the clout to do it, whatever, whatever. But yeah, there's no, nothing is going to happen tomorrow. People are kind of getting their irons in the fire so that when things are ready to launch, people know who the four or five people to talk to or eight or 10 to talk to. That's what's going on here. And I think I told somebody the other day, I think we'll know that something is really seriously happening is when all this stuff suddenly clams up and we don't hear all these rumors. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think, like you said, that the producers had a feeling that Star Trek needed rest and that the fan interest was waning. I think the fact that all these rumors, they take on a life of their own so quickly, and all the different websites write articles about, oh, Star Trek is coming back to television and there have been these meetings. I think it just highlights the fact that fans really do want to have Star Trek back on television. That's, everyone is just so itching for any news that might indicate that it's going to happen in a specific time frame. And so at least that should be a signal to the studio that the audience is there. Well, that's all we have in news today, Larry. But before we jump into the feature where we're going to talk about Relics, which is one of the scripts you mentioned.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, yeah.
Trekland Trunk.
That'll be a lot of fun.
We'd like to tell everyone about our other sponsor for this show, and that is Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create your own blog, website, or portfolio. And also, Squarespace makes it extremely easy to sell items online with their integrated commerce feature. Now, when commerce first launched earlier this year, it was available in the US. It's now available in the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Spain. So it's really branching out to everyone. The commerce goes through Stripe, which is a very popular online commerce solution these days. Squarespace has teamed up with Stripe to integrate it into the platform, and it makes it very easy for you to just go with a 30-second merchant sign-up. It gives you instant approval. It does not require any paperwork, and you can begin receiving money for purchases via direct deposit in moments, and full tax and shipping rules by region also help you run your store. Plus, there's a fantastic order management interface that lets you easily track outstanding orders, resend customer update emails, print packing slips from a single interface. You can even move your existing Shopify or Big Cartel inventories over to Squarespace with just a few clicks. And this sounds like a perfect solution for the Trekland trunk, in fact, Larry. You know, you could put your products up there. People can come right in, just order them in no time without leaving your site, and it would make life really easy for you because it also handles tax calculations by region as well as your shipping. Very, very easy solution. And commerce starts at just $24 per month. It's a fantastic price for what you get. And if you want to create just a website, a blog, or portfolio, they have those plans that start at just $8 per month. And the best way to find out how great Squarespace is and how great the tools are is just to try it free for yourself. And you can do that free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. You just go and enter your name and an email address, and in a matter of minutes, you will be creating your own site. And best of all, as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using our offer code TREK10. So just go to squarespace.com and try it for free. You're going to love it. Trek FM is built on Squarespace. That shows how much we love it. And again, don't forget to use offer code TREK10 to save 10%. And if you choose the annual plan, you'll also get a free custom domain registration as well. So go check it out. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM. When generations hit the big screen, they pass the baton from one generation to the next, hence the title. But actually, you know, the baton was really passed on before McCoy appeared in Encounter at Farpoint, and in a much bigger role, Scotty came aboard the Enterprise in the sixth season episode, Relics. And today we're going to talk about that episode. And to help us do that, we have with us two of our co-hosts from our TNG show, Earl Grey, drinking out of their Earl Grey mugs tonight. We have Philip Gilfus and Daniel Prue. Hey guys, how are you doing?
Doing great, Chris.
In your intro, you did kind of jump right over unification, which I have a little problem with.
I did, yes.
And
Spock is there
with
too.
The jumping or with the show?
Yeah. Oh, not with the show. Well, not with the first part of the show. No, it's great.
Yes, of course, Spock was in unification. Everyone remembers that. And of course, I remember that episode quite well because it was out right around the same time that Undiscovered Country was in the theater. And a great moment there as well. But those episodes together really, I feel, passing the baton even before we get to Generations. And getting these guys to sign on, so we won't talk about DeForest Kelly or Leonard Nimoy signing on TNG tonight, but we will talk about James Doohan signing on. And Larry, what could you tell us about the backstory of Relics, the genesis of the story, and of course, what went into getting James Doohan to sign on to TNG?
Well, I think the big, hairy, long story that they about getting James Doohan to sign on was they called him and said, hey, do you want to do this? And he said, yeah. And that was it. No.
Easy.
No, I
it wasn't. So he didn't want 20 times top of show like Shatner apparently did to be on.
No,
Enterprise.
I think, no, the story generated, this is sixth season. They had had Spock on. The big thing was, you know, Nimoy in the fifth season. And everybody's got to remember that we look at these like they're just, you know, boxes on the shelf of DVDs. And this is a thing of you had the original series and then you had these upstart guys who turned the corner and now they're the big hot deal. And the only thing left in the Star Trek universe to deal with is gee, when are we going to start having crossovers? And well, you know, yes, Dee played McCoy in the pilot, and that was kind of their little send-off baton. And then the big thing was Spock and Unification. That had been fifth season and the anniversary year and the tie-in to six and all that. And so now it's kind
of
like,
well, and of course we had Sarek as well.
Yes, yes, yes.
Shouldn't forget that because listeners will point out Sarek.
Yeah, yeah. And Ensign Jabrowski's grandfather was in the Royale in second season, so we can't forget that.
All bases covered.
Yeah, yeah. Tongue firmly in cheek there. No, but I mean, it was almost like it was a little bit of who's left, and what's the situations you can do with them. And of course, the Holy Grail would be having Kirk in some way, and that wasn't going to just happen. And I mean, Nimoy was only in because of his directing deal for six, not directing deal, but his participation in that, and they made that a big promotional thing between TVs and the movies for the anniversary year. So that was kind of a special thing, and that wasn't going to come along again. And until you had Kirk back, it was kind of, what are we going to do on a TV scale? And they really had what's kind of cool, and I had this in the companion, they had bought a premise from a writer, a guy named Michael Rupert, just about a crewman saving himself in a transporter loop. And Michael at the time said, let's buy that. And next time we want to bring an original series person back, we'll use that as our device. And that's all it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but they'd done McCoy. And I have a quote from Ron where he said, well, who would we use in that? That would be cool. And if we want to do something for a sweeps month, who would it be? It's like, well, McCoy is old. He said, Spock's playing James Bond on Romulus. We don't want to touch Kirk yet. For the cooties. No, we don't want to. That's such a huge thing. We don't want to blow that up. You know, let's save that for a movie or something bigger.
That sounds racy, Larry.
Who's left? And so they thought, you know, they extended out to Jimmy and see if that would work. And yeah. And that was really the genesis of it. And it's okay. Six seasons. So there's kind of a maturity. You know, it's a thing of you do things in your sixth season. You don't do in your first or second. And they're looking for stunt things. They're looking for, but the cool things, not goofy jump the shark type things. So that's, you know, it was pretty simple. But yeah, they that one kid, that's why there's not a story credit. They just used his premise. But there you go.
Okay. Clean, easy story there. Philip and Daniel, you guys being the TNG guys hosting our TNG show, how did you guys feel when you got to this episode the first time? Did you see it when it aired, or did you see it later on in reruns?
Well, I know Daniel being the young Geordi to my old Scotty probably did not see this when it aired. I'm pretty sure I did. And I was probably very excited. I mean, my sort of very brief Star Trek evolution is I saw the original series movies first, and then came to The Next Generation, and then came to the original series show. So I only knew Scotty as he was, you know, in Relics as sort of the mustache and, you know, slightly larger guy, gray hair. And so it's always hard when I finally saw the actual, you know, original Scotty, it was like, oh, are those two people the same person? So it was kind of cool to see, because the whole black vest and the white shirt was just, you know, that's Scotty, you know. So
yeah,
it was definitely a cool thing to see.
And I'll have both Philip and our listeners know that I was six when this first aired, so I was well able to remember and enjoy the episode completely.
I was watching Next Generation when you were in diapers, Daniel.
Diapers. It's like vegetable.
Yeah,
only a different actor.
Going yeah. through the TNG, you know what I remember from when I was younger. I didn't like Philip. I didn't know the TOS characters at all. I knew it was something special, like you know, even pop culture, it's Scotty. Everybody knows who Scotty is. I knew who he was. I was aware of him, but it was such a fun episode that I didn't really need the background so much. And now that I know it, it's that much more fulfilling.
You know, it makes me wonder when Jimmy Doohan signed on, like, did the contract, and knowing Ron Moore, I think, did the contract be like, you must say in this episode, it's coming apart at some point?
It said you must drink whiskey.
Yeah, yeah. Here's all the essentials. Here's the bullet points we want. No, I think, well, as considering it was Ron Moore who wrote the show, I don't think anybody had to, you know, insist on anything being in. He was going to have it there. And And yeah, and I, you know, Michael Piller is not real happy with the way unification. He's always looked at that as a lost, a missed opportunity. He was always disappointed that it wasn't a bigger thing than it was. It was a big event, but the meat of the story, he always thought there were some failings. He wished they'd had time to refine and do some beefing up in places. So, and everybody loves the D. Kelly sign. So this was, of all of those things, and you know, a couple years before before the Kirk bit in Generations, this was really kind of, I think, the most satisfying for a lot of them on the show. This was like the most satisfying. And it touched most of the cast, certainly, more than, I mean, you know, with Leonard, he was just working with Patrick and Brent, and with Picard and Data and all the Romulan cast. I mean, it didn't really involve the rest of the series, the rest of the cast. And Dee's scene was a secret thing he and Brent did back, you know, they kept it secret. So, and who knew?
Let me ask you, Larry, in this episode, if I recall correctly, Marina Sirtis actually shot scenes with James Doohan, right? And they were cut from this episode.
Well, and yes, and that was
because you wonder at the end, like, you've got this guy who's been, he's from 75 years in the past. He's on the ship trying to come to terms with feeling old and useless. And where's the counselor? And then she shows up at the very end of the episode to send him off. Sorry, you know, I was in the sauna the whole time you were on the ship. I can help you.
You're being very rational. Most people just saw him give her, you know, smack her one. I mean, plant one, not punch her out. And was like, well, when did they have their little moment to get, you know, or does he always just go down the line and...
The old tiger still has it.
yep. So, no, there was a scene. The one thing that was cut for time was they did have a scene together. And you were talking about the DVDs. We're talking about the 6-season Blu-rays coming out. From day one, everybody's gotten excited about these deleted scenes and missing scenes. And of the entire run of the series, if you had said, 4 or 5 years ago, if you'd said, if we can find a deleted scene in the entire 7 years of Next Generation, what would it be? The first thing in my mind was the Troy scene of Relics. Now, I'm saying that, I mean, at least in a sentimental and a fun way, if not, maybe not pivotal or something. And I've been bugging Rob Burnett for the last couple of years. Well, have you found it? Do you have it? Do you find it? You have it? And I think, I don't want to say anything because I don't think it's in the PR, but I think he was saying, giving me positive vibes on that. So that's my favorite thing of the whole thing, because it's a really cute scene. If anybody goes and drags the script, it was in the script that's been out, if you can get a hold of it. I don't know if TrekCore has it up publicly, but it's a very cute scene where Geordi finally says, I know what to do. And he and Scotty sits down and thinks he flirts with Crusher in the sickbay scene. He's going to flirt with this one. And halfway through, she does enough of the, how are you feel? How does that make you feel? And he finally gets it. And he goes from Mr. Smooth to pissed off Scotty, like, you know, to 180. And he's like, I don't need a psychiatrist. And she's like, no, it's okay. And she's doing her best 24th century Troy softy on him. And he basically... he says, I know what I need, and it's not a visit with a shrink. And the very next thing you see him say, when he says, I know what I need, and it's not a visit with a shrink, and the very next thing you see is him ordering Intent Forward from and Data's gonna mix up a drink. So you get the thing of, I just need a drink. And they go into the it's green moment, and
it's green.
Now in the Troy Scotty scene, do they exchange different types of accents?
Because you always wondered where Troy's went, but the script is, it's really a cute scene, and I'm sure they had a lot of fun doing it, but anyway, that's one of the sentimental moments that I've always hoped, because it was a regular, you know, 3 or 4 page scene, so just completely trimmed out for time.
It's just something that always really stood out to me, even before I knew that there had been a scene that had been shot and got cut, was, why is there a counselor on the ship? And here's a situation where if someone ever needed counseling while they were on the ship, Scotty really needed to talk to somebody, and then she was not there. So,
well, but what's really sad is the missed opportunity we had after Cause and Effect, when you could see her counseling all 127 members of the Bozeman crew. You know, when they come out of the time.
It would have been interesting to see her psychoanalyzing Frasier. So that would have been...
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's like Inception.
Actually, we should... I was going back and reading my some of my notes from Companion. Actually, when they did Cause and Effect, the bridge they come back to where Kelsey Grammer's Captain Bates, and aside from the story of they wanted to go rob Cheers and have Kirstie Alley standing behind him as Savick on his crew, and Kirstie wouldn't do it, or they couldn't do it, or so they just had a generic woman in Vulcan back there, and have it be a double quickie, you know, cute cameo. They at the time, Ron had pushed to have that bridge be a Constitution class bridge, and have it be a Kirk era that had been there another 100, you know, another 20 or 30 years more, instead of it having to be a. But the reality is, the movie bridge parts were cheap and easy to pull out of storage. They would have had to build a bridge piece, and they couldn't have fudged it. They would have needed to build a decent thing to have, you know, have that angle of a shot around a captain's chair. So he really wanted to do it then, and they said, "Oh my God, there's no way, there's no time, there's no how." So part of that was also what was driving doing this. They went into this show going, "Come on, come on, come on, we've got to do it." And of course, they only built the turbo lift alcove and engineering, and shot behind that, using the clip from This Side of Paradise of the empty bridge. You know, they went, Dan Curry found that, and they had that, and they had that little pie shaped piece, and Steve Horch is a fan that did it at conventions. He had a helm and captain's chair ready. So they really only had to build the engineering station and turbo lift alcove. And so it was still a doable thing. It was still a lot of money, and they did it from scratch because I was rereading this, and it was like, we've come so far where now it's like they've done these bridges and they've refined the plans over the years. But when they did this, it was, you know, six seasons. So it's 92, 93. They had to go and do it. And Richard James says, we were doing what a fan would do. We were getting stills and tracks and figuring camera angles and measurements and dimensions and paint chips and doing it from scratch.
It's just what Philip's doing in his garage right now, right? That's what you told us when you were on literature.
My blueprints of the Enterprise D. Yeah.
There's that scene where when Scotty walks over to the turbo lift door and then stops, and I'm thinking that they told him, "Look, we didn't build any more of the ship, so when you get there, make sure try to go through the door." Because you're also thinking, well, it's the holodeck. It's probably recreated the entire ship. You know, if he goes through the door, he should be able to walk through. But no, I'm going to stay on the bridge. I'm going to hang out here. I'm going to resist the urge to go to engineering.
And I guess the holodeck safeties weren't on because he could have done a, you know, Roslyn chaise and gone down the empty shaft if it had. Anyway.
Now, I mean, I had a quick question with Jimmy Doohan, you know, being Scotty in the 24th century and sort of the difference between being an engineer in the original series and being an engineer in Next Generation. You know, he had to deal with the technobabble of the Next Generation, which, you know, that wasn't necessarily there in TOS. I mean, he seemed to do well with it, but I wonder how, you know, that was a challenge him to have to learn
that. I do think that it was, I mean, he was in his... in his 70s here, and it was an awful lot of dialogue. And I know they had to be, I mean, they knew, and he was patient. And you see it, it's all there. But I know it was, some of the stuff is, and doing a Scottish brogue on top of saying, you know, inverted polar on a mid earth or whatever it is he's saying in this. They got through just fine. This was Alex. I was just going through some of my stuff. This was Alex Singer's first episode that he drew to direct, and he had been a director in the 60s and could have directed. He wanted to direct the original series in the last year and didn't get a chance to. But this was the first time they had one of those were all, you know, that would come up later on, like when they did Flashback on Voyager and when they did Trials and Tribs on Tribulations on DS9 and Inner Mirror Darkly on Enterprise. It's like every series got at least one or two shows where increasingly they got to do a throwback, and everybody got to feel, you know, all warm and fuzzy, and people would come down and visit and everything. I was still in Oklahoma when they shot this, because I'd written the first companion but hadn't come out, so I didn't see this. But I saw pictures of, you know, it's just a little pie-shaped piece that they actually built on set. And then faked it with the reverse angles and how they did it. But it's like they took that feeling and then, you know, times 10 for Flashback, and then times 100 for Trials and Tribulations, and then times 500 for Intermirror. By the time of Intermirror Darkly, they were so grasping for any good feel good stuff, because Enterprise is on the bubble so badly that, But yeah, but that was the first time everybody got one of these, ooh, and you had one of these, everybody dives in and does the cool thing. You know, like all the art department dives in and goes bonkers. And it's like the baby steps of everybody going bonkers with throwback stuff and recreating everything. And so it's like what as the amount of energy and PR and everything that they got out of this show, it's like, it's just amazing now that like, this is a fraction of, you know, as we all know, where it got crazy with Trials and Tribs and then in a Darkly.
Right.
But I would have loved to have been there and seen him doing it again.
What do you guys think about this as the passing of the baton, as I mentioned at the beginning? Because Generations was sort of the official passing of the baton on the big screen of, okay, we've got the original series crew there on the B at the beginning. Kirk's going to meet Picard. He's ultimately going to die. So it's just the TNG crew after this. But for me, really, this episode is where I feel more like the writers are passing the baton from the original series to the Next Generation, because you actually get to do it through Scotty, and you get to feel the difference in the time period and how our heroes would react to it. And then Scotty himself struggling with the difference, like many fans did, many fans who grew up with the original series having to come to terms with the idea of the Next Generation, which I think by the sixth season, everything is fine. People are fine with TNG. But when it first came on, a lot of fans felt the way I think Scotty feels when he sets foot on the Enterprise D, which a lot of Next Generation fans don't like it when you point out that the Enterprise D is like a hotel in space. However, Scotty actually makes the comment in this episode that his quarters feel like a hotel in space. So Scotty said it. Not
well, it's a bigger ship.
Much, much bigger.
That, I was
where
gonna
have
go,
you put
that
me?
Was every time they say, oh, it's the higher regions of space. I want to go, that was the point. It was like, that, was that wasn't point. Just yeah, like, yeah. Oh, it's 1986 and let's just run away with our spending on a set. It's like, no, that was the technology unchanged. Bring your family. It's not the 60s. We're not on a sub, you know, anyway. But yeah, that's a great point, Chris. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that is good. Of course, the sad thing about the Generations prologue scenes is that was such a compromise from what they originally wanted.
Right.
It was such they had wanted the whole cast in and really had more of a feeling. But I think they kind of, if all the actors who said, no way, this is a, we did our big farewells in six, and this is going to be a cheap thing just to have us all there when you're really, it's only really going to be about Kirk. Not that they're being selfish, but if the pivot point is going to be Kirk anyway, we're just in there as kind of, we're just a TOS porn standing here, you know? It's like, we're just gratuitous. And they pulled out and they wanted two to go with him, and Jimmy and Walter were the two to go. No, I mean, I'm serious. That's what they did. They said, this is pointless. We all have two lines apiece. And if we could really have a partnered movie.
I'm sorry. You just,
we're not getting past TOS porn. I'm sorry. Just let it. You've thrown it down there. And it's there.
He followed up.
To look at it for a second.
He followed up the TOS porn line with, and then we had to pull out. And that was it for me.
I got it. Well, but back to what you said, Chris. It is this. It's like this Scotty show, the emotion and the sentimentality and speaking to the audience, like you said, wrenching from – that's really a good bit. I like that. Wrenching from the 60s to the 80s, yeah. And this is addressing – Ron is taking the voice of the people trying to make a bridge and having Scotty speak for that with the hotel and space line. But also just Ron writing the point of view of people doing that, because a lot of original series people never did come back to – what's weird is a lot of – original series fans came back out of the woodwork for Enterprise, which seems to be a lost vibe somewhere, as since Enterprise is supposed to be hated. Yeah. But
it's not just the hotel line either, though. But when he goes to the holodeck and he's on the bridge and he talks to Picard, and finally he tells the computer, like, shut this bloody thing off. And I was thinking, you know, voice recognition technology has really advanced, because try telling Siri to shut this bloody thing off and see if your iPhone shuts down. It's not going to work.
It doesn't happen.
You've got to say it just right. And so, but that's, you know, the moment of realizing that you have to let go of the past to move forward. And then, of course, when he's on the Janolan with Geordi, and Geordi finally realizes also, and Geordi says, you know, just because something's old doesn't mean you throw it away.
Now,
and even Geordi had to come to terms with it in reverse.
What was kind of curious too, we were talking about the evolution of the show. This, I think I have a first draft that's going to be one of the things I have in my Trekland trunk sale later, but I was flipping through. The story itself, as far as elements go, are pretty much... this is one of those shows that kind of wrote itself and was fairly easy once they decided it would be Scotty and once they decided it would how much the bridge they would do and how they would structure it. But there's little pieces through here. Like I was reading his first draft, which, you know, they've gone through a story in the script process. This is a first draft script. So they've gone through the prose document and everybody's talked about it and they've broken it. So this is a fairly, this is like halfway, two thirds of the way along in the story process. But originally he wasn't necessarily retiring. They were going to the same colony. And apparently Ron Moore had just been to Australia and pulled all the Sydney class transport and the Janolan caves. And some of the story I didn't
That's
know.
That's why
I
Data just, poured him a glass of Foster's and tinfoil.
Yes. But the whole thing, even one of the helm, one of the off crew are named Ensign Rager, or Picard says Rager, but somebody made a joke about Ron dancing at this convention like a Rager, which was Aussie slang for wild man partier. And he named the helm guy Ensign Rager. And then Picard said Rager, but which is a cool little backstory. But there were little, just some little things where, like, he apparently wasn't retired or on his way to being retired. And he makes, you know, there's a line that everybody loves to make a point of, the line where he says, "I knew Jim Kirk himself would come get me." And everyone says, "Yes, but Scotty had seen Kirk die. Blah, blah. Oh, he's just disoriented." And that was, you know, this was 2 years before they wrote, or a year or two before they wrote the Generation script. And Ron knew that at the time. And he's like, I don't care. We'll retcon that, but this is how we are, and we'll do it now. And we've got Jimmy for the prologue in the movie. But there's just some little pieces out, and that was just kind of interesting, that he's just talking about Chekhov and Kirk and everything, like they're all still at it. And he's not necessarily going to retire, and I think the choice of having him on his way to retirement, whoever came up with that in the process, it's more poignant to the whole I'm useless and old thing if he's already on his – if he's already on the path to retire. Which,
well, you know, he had just bought a boat, right?
But unfortunately, that boat did not already sail. And oh god, yeah, five lines, Star Trek 5 lines I could have done without. But anyway, just, but there were little things, and they make a point to say that he's 147 in this episode, which would have had him been born in 2222. But some of those little things. And there's a throwaway when Geordi is first showing him around the ship, and he's like going ooh ah and playing tourist, and Geordi says, "Oh, and wait till you see to the dolphins," which went away in the final.
Then he takes him down to cetacean.
Like, I can just see those guys are like trying to get the dolphins, and every time, and somebody either Rick is writing them, you know, penciling them out or something, but sneak them in.
Oh, once again, Commander Flipper gets into the editing room, cutting room floor.
That's right.
I knew you guys would love that.
That's right.
He's always there, just in the background.
He's always there. Always there.
Yep. Faster than lightning.
Another thing that stood out to me, because we're talking about, you know, him coming out of the transporter and saying, "Oh, Jim Kirk probably got the Enterprise out of mothballs to come get me." He survived in a transporter. I know it's Scotty and he's a miracle worker, but he survived in the transporter buffer for 75 years. Now, how many times on The Next Generation is there an emergency where we're going to lose somebody? We can't keep them in the buffer for more than a couple of hours, something like that. And it's a big crisis. And he's been in there for 75 years.
They don't make them like they used to.
They do.
That's probably the answer, because that's when they get to the Janolan and they find out, you know, that old hardware. Look at our space probes, you know, most of our Voyager and these other probes we have out there. I mean, the technology level is 60s technology, 70s technology, but it all still works.
It's interesting that
And today you can buy a TV and it breaks in 2 years.
It's funny that you bring that up, because I just watched tonight, actually, I watched Realm of Fear, which is like 2 or 3 or 4 episodes before this one. And they're like, "Barkley, we can't keep you in the transporter for more than 30 seconds or you'll just degrade and die."
Yeah, right.
Like, and I'm like, wait a minute.
Right. That's what I'm talking about.
You just watched Relics. How can you not do that? I don't understand.
Only the Janolans special transporters can do that.
Three words,
upgraded,
guys.
They weren't Scotty.
That's true.
That's right.
That's true.
Oh, poor Franklin. Poor Franklin. Drink one for you, buddy.
Poor Franklin, yeah.
And real quick, right before you mentioned this, the corridor scene where Geordi and Scotty are walking down the corridor when they first, you know, meet and stuff. I don't know if this was on purpose or if no one noticed, but Scotty's arms in a sling, and Geordi keeps like rigorously grabbing it and shaking it, like getting all excited about things. And I'm like, the man, like, he's probably broken or something. Like, leave him alone. He's old. Like, it could, his arm could fall off. I don't know. I, you know, who knows?
Daniel, I can't believe they're letting you host a show about Next Generation. See, Geordi's blind.
This was the one time the Rhymelins hadn't taken his visor over.
I also like how Scotty's really surprised to see Worf, but he never ever asks anybody why there's a hair barrette on Geordi's face.
Usual reasons.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm flipping through this before we ran out of time. They had meant to have Guinan in this show to add to the specialness of it and to have her be the one that talks to Scotty. And they couldn't get Whoopi famously. The longer they went with her, the less she was available to get out of other things. And as her career took off after Ghost, and they couldn't have her. But anyway, she was originally supposed to do the 10 forward scene with the green.
But she had plenty of time to do Time Zero.
Well, and I can see them going, okay, we can't get Guinan. If only there was someone whose job it was to sort people out. Data. Don't we have... No, Data.
How about random crew member number 3 who doesn't know the difference between synthahol and alcohol?
Would have been a good time to spotlight the wonderful tin forward waiter uniform, too. You know, the blue, the green and black special there. Czech special.
Yeah. Oh, that... For me, it always goes back to Lower Decks, where his name isn't listed in the credits, but I am convinced that that's Meshach Taylor playing the waiter in 10-4 Lower Decks.
You think that. Here, now, this is Ron Moore in his first draft. His original line when Scotty goes to the holodeck to call it up, and Majel says, the computer says, there are 5 Federation ships with that name, plus specified by, and he's in the famous, actually, this is my favorite line of the whole show that pops up with other uses is no bloody A, B, C, or D. You know, it's that's very useful in a lot of situations. But he wrote the line as NCC 1701, no bloody A, B, or C, A, B, C, or D, and show her the way she was before Stardate 5928. So this is anal Ron Moore fanboy writing this for everybody he knew would say, what about the Enterprise when it was refit and it wasn't the A yet? You know? Someone went, I'm sure, you know, Jerry or Michael or Rick went, you don't have to say, you know. And of course, I'm sitting here instantly thinking, well, what about the animateds? This was when they weren't canon, and the animateds were higher star dates, and it was still the original series Enterprise, and it was the pre-motion picture Enterprise.
But in order to see that Enterprise on the holodeck, you have to put in special 3D glasses before you walk in to see the animated one. So,
yeah. So you know what we always forget about though, and I don't know what to mess up your order. Chris, but what we almost forget about is the whole sidebar plot of the Dyson sphere being in this thing and that whole concept it's like an interwoven B story, but the whole thing of, oh, and this wacky 50s or this 50s scientist's wacky theory that later on he even said, oh, that was just kind of crazy talk. They use, you know, and build the, and on the budget, build that, Greg, there's pictures of Greg Jean sitting in the wall they built. You know, and then they did Eric Chauvin did a matte painting of the inside, you know, of the sphere of this Earth-like surface. But it's on the inside of this ball facing, it's kind of like Unada times 1,000, you know, it's kind of wacky. But that all gets lost because we're also sucked up in remembering, you know, Scotty and the missing Troy scene and everything and the It's Green. And
that's one thing I wanted to ask you guys, because The Dyson sphere concept is very interesting, and I, you know, over the years I read a lot of science books because I'm really interested in science, and so I knew about the concept of a Dyson sphere before this episode came on even, and so it's a really interesting concept. And I was watching the episode this morning again, and you know, we get like, I don't know, we're like more than 20 minutes, we're more than halfway through the episode, I think, before they ever really go inside the sphere. And so I was thinking, would we have enjoyed seeing this Dyson sphere exploration as a completely separate episode where that is the main plot of the episode, is that they encounter a Dyson sphere And they explore that and they kind of get into the science of it a little bit, because this episode for me is, it's just completely Scotty, and they're just, there's this Dyson sphere in the episode, but it doesn't feel like it's really part of the story.
It's the Dyson sphere in the room.
Other than to trap everyone so that Scotty has to save them.
Well, it's,
would you
is,
like to see this as a separate episode?
Just sitting
episode?
Here, it's something I never even thought about, and I'm, hopefully I did somewhere in the last, I don't know, 20 years or something, was who built it, and why are they not living on the inside, and what, you know, somewhere on the surface?
Well, they moved because the sun was starting to have a lot of solar flares and stuff.
Yeah.
Something you might have want to thought about before you built an entire sphere around a sun. But I'm not going to get into it.
Well, originally it was going to be fine, but then the people constructing it, you know, the months turned into years. You know how it works with any project, and by that time it was almost going nova. Ugh. So you know.
Yeah,
I'm glad that it's
for a long time. When you came in, you were blinded by all the orange cones everywhere. Yeah. It was basically like you lived in Atlanta and the Dyson Sphere was the interstate system.
I'm glad. I don't know how everybody else feels. I'm glad that this is like a B-minus plot. Like, it's really pushed back and we don't have to think about it. We don't have to care about it. The episode makes no apologies for how much this is just a setup for the Scotty storyline. And I'm glad, because I don't think it would stand up if it was pushed any further to the front.
I mean, I think the challenge of doing the Dyson Sphere, you know, I forget what that wonderful website is that, you know, compares all the sci-fi starships, battleships, and everything in the world. And the Dyson Sphere, of course, is the hugest thing on there. but when you watch this episode, I mean, I think it's a great concept. Difficult to translate on screen how big this is supposed to be. I mean, I think the moment when the Enterprise D was inside, you could kind of see, like, it was supposed to be like, what, 250 million class M planets? That's off the top of my head. I might be wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, the outside. And
all 10 to the 16th square kilometers.
Yeah, all the outside shots, it's like, it's the Enterprise D next to this gray thing. I'm like, I mean, I felt like the Corbomite maneuver did a better job of showing size in relation to.
And you had a movie budget with motion picture, and Voyager was supposed to be two AUs, you know, Earth, and that's kind of what this was supposed to be also. And if it was hard to do on a movie budget, you know, whether or not you're rushing to get your prints in the can to send them out, but yeah, if it's hard enough to do there, my God, they're on their little TV track and everything.
And their throwaway line of like, oh, we didn't notice it because there's so much gravity interference. Like, you have like this incredible sensor technology and you've never been to this part of space where there's this massive metal ball. It just doesn't, I just don't get it. It makes no sense to me.
I just dawned on me. I don't know that we marked this location, finding the Janolan on our star charts. Maybe Jeff did on his map.
No.
But anyway,
we're going to need a second edition.
Oh, no,
Mary.
We can't have that. Yeah.
And be sure to put it in the back as a second part and not as a.
None of that happens this
and
time.
And let's not forget, too, about relics that in Star Trek, of course, they have elements that they reuse quite often, like the Mutara Nebula, for example. This gave us the wonderful opportunity on Voyager to see Voyager escape through the closing space doors of the Dyson Sphere. Worst ever reuse of a prop.
Oh, that's right. I had not,
Because you're watching it. It's so recognizable. And because this is the James Doohan episode, right? It's so recognizable to Star Trek fans. The doors of the Dyson Sphere and the Enterprise going through. And when you see Voyager fly through there, you're like,
with the,
okay, look, I just can't dispel my disbelief this time.
It's been a whole 5 years later or something, Chris. So no one's going to remember that. No one's going to notice that.
No one's going to notice that. Scotty was on the Next Generation.
You know, we'll
really
have endless reruns.
Is there like a book about that or something?
DVDs and eventually HD that will show every coffee stain on every uniform. Oh, no.
I bet that when Voyager is remastered for Blu-ray, that scene is replaced with something else besides the doors of the Dyson Sphere.
Well, I hope so. I'm sure it's, we'll find out. I don't know if it's been egging on at Mike the way some things might have been, but yeah. I did come across one thing here just scanning some of my notes that I wanted to mention. The dropped Troy scene was just in a throwaway line when he's starting to protest and get pissed off. when Scotty is. She makes an offhanded comment that we've had counselors in Starfleet for about 40 years, which is kind of a nice little – but that went away, so it's not canon. So, but another thing, they talk – since you're getting it – they took the opportunity to talk about some, you know, transporters and shields and sensors and subspace radio. He makes that comment about,
they did
it's
a
not
lot
that
40
changed.
Years ago. So the introduction of counselors on ships coincided with the changing to isolinear chips with the transporter system. Mm-hmm. That also happened 40 years ago.
It's all
somehow it's connected.
It's
there must have been a big accident that required a lot of counseling for those involved in the transporter accident, as well as a redesign of transporter technology.
Yeah, they had a bunch of dips in their chips that needed some counseling. Was that, let's see, 44 years, that would be what? That would be pre all the stuff in the 40s, right? That would be pre Narendra 3, and that would be pre... pre-loss of that. That's like 33 years, something. Yeah. Anyway. Josh, that's such a black hole of time. Don't you think a new TV series could be set in that whole BC era? I mean, what was the Tomet incident in that anyway? What a perfect place to put a series.
A prequel that's after the prequel, but before the sequel. I don't know what the...
A requel?
Another hit Star Trek series, unless you fuck it up. That's what I would call it.
While we're mentioning the door closing scene, I just wanted to bring this up real quickly. That one of the few rules that Star Trek seems to stick to most of the times, like, now, of course, there's exceptions, is you cannot transport through shields. And that absolutely happens in this scene where they're like, they're flying through, they teleport them through the shields and then shoot the photon torpedoes, which also aren't supposed to go through shields, through the ship and blow it up. So I just had a problem.
Well, let me tell you, in the late 23rd century, those transporters were awesome and everything else. Shields, terrible. That's the worst technology. That we've had a great breakthrough in the past 78 years in shield technology.
Well, aside from the fact that in the day I asked Ron about it and he said, we just screwed up. I screwed up. The producer screwed up. Mike and Rick and it wouldn't be Andre then. It would have been Lorraine as the science advisor. It's like nobody caught it. And then I immediately said in my helpful retconning way, well, last year you had the whole thing about beaming through shields in the wounded when they cycled through and had this frequency that was the, you know, whatever. And then later on, I saw someone else say, well, they had reinforced the shields at the door points, which meant there were weak spots to get through. So that doesn't bother me as much. But yeah, it's one of those basic things that they...
My explanation is that they've been holding the door open. The shields are getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And so the shields are weak enough at that point that they're able to beam through. Like if they were full strength, they couldn't beam through. But the shields are going to collapse very soon. So they're able to beam them out. And because if you think about it, if Scotty can survive in a transport buffer for 75 years, I mean, pretty much all bets are off in terms of continuity and transporter technology in this episode in the first place. So why not beam them through weak shields?
Well, Scotty would point out that was only a 50% solution.
That's right.
That's right.
Poor Franklin.
Poor Franklin.
Probably what happened was that Scotty wrote the book on transporters and he fudged it. You know, he was very conservative, at least on paper. And it's actually possible to beam through shields if the shields are below 40%. It'll work.
All right. Well, if that's what works in your mind, I'll go with it. That's fine.
And if the captain asks for it, you know, you got to treat him like a baby.
Oh, Captain.
I did love Scotty giving LaForge the advice. Starfleet captains are like children. Never tell them how long it's really going to take. And Scotty just assumes that everyone who works in engineering anyway wants to be thought of as a miracle worker, right?
I just love how that retcons the entire TOS series. So every time you're watching an original series and you're like, Scotty, like, I can't do it, Captain. It'll take 5 days. It's like, it's going to take me 30 minutes. Easy breezy, yeah. But we're just going to tell Captain Kirk over there.
I'll start on
he
it.
He could have restarted the naked time cold restart, you know, in about a couple of minutes. But, you know, it sounds way cool to say, I've got to have 30 minutes. And, you know, it puts everything in a whole new light. No, you were talking about, you know, making – when you have a – it's almost like having a fun show like this that's fun for the fans and fun for the crew to do. And everybody knows it's going to be one of those things. And people come down and visit. and they have guests on set, and they're lucky to get the damn thing shot. It's almost like part of the ingredient of that is for the writer to start the ball rolling with things like you were saying, making fun of the, geez, my room is like, you take all the things that are the memes and the stereotypes and the ruts that everybody's into, and you get to at least turn them on their head and make fun of them, which makes them even more canonized now that we're admitting to them, you know, and you say, oh, my room's like a hotel, and you play with the miracle worker, you know, bit. You take all that stuff and turn it on its ear to make it more real, and it gives it more texture, and it just adds to the feel goodness of the whole story when you, you know, pull those things out.
Well, I mean, like Riker got to do that in the close your ears, Chris. Riker got to do that in the Enterprise episode, These Are the Voyages, when he complained about how small everything was. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, but that was, yeah, and that was. That was part of the. That was part of the.
Well,
the game
Riker needs space. You know, it's. Yeah. It's hard to prop your leg up on stuff on the NX-01 because you're always banging it into walls and.
Well, it's hard to.
No
it's
fish
hard to
in
sling
the
your. It's hard to sling your leg over the chair if your leg is going to bang into the side of the room. You know.
He could have just had Porthos follow him around. Just propped his leg up on Porthos whenever he needed. You know what I mean? Like. Yes.
I like, for those listening, Larry just got up, stood up so that he could prop his leg up on something and do the Riker maneuver.
Oh, I was just trying to swing for us on camera. Leg around, yeah.
With a beard. So,
with a beard. True.
That was second season beard, yeah. Which is going away in about 3 days. So.
This is post-season 2 Larry we're seeing here. So.
Right, that series, I guess, yeah. Yeah, that'll never see the light of day. Yeah, no, this was and this was like the fourth show of the season they did. So they came back and they were able to, you know, when you consider that the first shows before, I guess Realm of Fear was kind of a cool show. Barclay and the Plasma Beasties and all that. But like Man of the People was a real dog. And the comeback on Time Zero's comeback, aside from the costumes, was kind of, yeah. So this was kind of like a highlight of the early part of the year. You know, it was for sweeps month ratings and all that. But it's one of those things where if they'd like to do these shows early in the year or like late in the year, so they have a running start to, because on their curve, the they did a lot of visual effects, and this is pre-CG. So they're doing them. You know, they took the Star Trek VI little transport shuttle that you barely saw, flipped it over, and that was the Janolan. You know, and all of a sudden building the Dyson Sphere and everybody doing all this stuff because it's a cool episode and doing it at half price because they're all art department fanboy geeks like Greg Jean and all the staff guys, and you know, Mike and Rick and everybody. And but they've got the time to do that and they're not all bogged down in the middle of the year. They got to run it. They knew the script was coming in the first ones of the batch of the season and they had time to like get a running start and get some extra stuff done before they all got exhausted and run down in the middle of the year. So that's a little bit too. I mean, and seeing them looking around and going, oh, this can be our cool thing of the, you know, last year we had the 2-part Spock episode in the fall sweeps. Gosh, now what are we going to do for this? And that's context. And that's also the kind of thing that, and I don't know how like the commentaries go or whatever, but that's the kind of thing that when you're watching the shows and they're just boxes on a shelf, those are the kind of things that add a little bit of, you know, a little bit of texture to it that gets lost as time goes by until you go back and go, oh, and it's fun to have that in the mix.
What if this had been a 2-parter and the Enterprise is flying towards the space doors and the Janolan is there and Picard says, fire, and then the screen goes black.
Dun, 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 dun.
They would have had to. Yeah. They would have really had to fill in the second part of the episode then, because they would have been outside the Dyson Sphere and been really boring. But you know,
half of it would have just been Scotty.
I'm thinking,
and Troy.
What would, how would you do? All of Troy's cutscenes would have been.
Maybe it would have been like the whole second episode would have been picking out Scotty's retirement community. You know, on whichever colony he wanted. You know what I mean?
They would have to put them in a big cargo bay. To transport them, yes.
And he's reading technical manuals for a fourth of the episode.
Because at the end of the episode, we're just kind of like, all right, you're old. You can leave now.
And here, and they're going to give him a shuttle pod, and he's looking kind of forlorn. Well, I don't know if you can handle one of our full-size shuttles, Mr. Scott. I think this little two-seater is the only thing you ought to take on. Oh, no. Are you kidding?
Great engineer, lousy pilot.
I can't show up with this little... This Volkswagen, I need a. This bug, I need.
It'll take you about 6 weeks to get anywhere important, but good luck. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure you won't encounter any hostile aliens along the way. We never do.
I think the great crime of this was they didn't come across him later on. You know, it's like why are you throwing him out there in the ether with this shuttlecraft when you're not going to come across him later on or whatever? Wouldn't it have been hysterical about the fourth season of Voyager when they're starting to really drag? And they're, oh my God! First I'm in a transporter loop for 75 years, and then this beastie sucks me to the other end of the. I cannot believe what my scanners are telling me.
Oh my God, that would have
been a lady captain. So what will they think of next?
Wait. Are you suggesting that James Doohan would have replaced Jerry Ryan in that season of Voyager?
Like no. I'm talking
the
about
boost that they needed.
I'm talking about when things dragged on Voyager there for a long time. It was like, who else did the caretaker bring over from our home turf that we could run into this season?
It's Scotty.
Just saying. I don't think he could have pulled off the cat suit the same way she did. That's all I'm saying.
No. Well, he might have pulled it off, but not of himself. Yeah.
In Larry's Star Trek porn that he talked about. Never mind.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Is that in the trunk, Larry?
What? Yeah. Hey, buddy. Come over here. I didn't say I wouldn't always have the Trekland trunk parked in the parking lot out back behind the warehouse. In the dingy
it's under
alley.
Jacket.
It's on, what is it, Robinson Street? What's the Enterprise episode?
Carpenter Street.
Carpenter Street.
Hey, you know what, though? He might have recognized Tuvok, right?
Yeah. He was...
From the Enterprise B.
Yeah, he would have recognized Tuvok.
Wait a minute.
Where does yours
come from?
Great.
I never forget a face, laddie. You don't have to be a freaking Superman to... Yeah. Oh.
All right. Well, let's move on to what will be coming up in 2014, which, of course, will be the remastering of Season 6. We're getting Season 5 in November, so Season 6, maybe like January, February range, probably. Larry, do you have... any information that you can share? Do you know anything about what might be coming up related to Relics in terms of remastering or any special?
Well, if they've already spilled the beans about the Troy scene, I haven't. I have to tell you that I haven't been snooping around like Roger and Mike and Rob Burnett as much as I had earlier on, just because there's been so much other stuff happening. And I'm just thrilled to hear about the Troy scene. I went down and sat like three different sessions and did documentary stuff for 4, 5, 6, and 7 in the first in all the years of Enterprise. So I don't know how much of that of me will wind up in the mix. Sometimes there's a lot of people and later next gen, as opposed to earlier, there's more people around as the generations change, no pun intended. And a lot of the guys are still around to talk and will talk now. And the corporate memory of things, so to speak, is post Michael Piller. So there's that generation of writers and producers to talk. I was thrilled to see that they got Jerry. I just emailed her today and she sent me back a thing and said, thank you. That for a long time, Jerry Taylor's been fighting some health issues and nothing like ongoing, just annoying little things, and she's kind of not wanted to not felt like, oh, you know, everybody's heard enough from me. And I was really wishing she would come up and claim her legacy, especially with Michael gone. And so I was really thrilled to see that she's doing the commentary for Unification, which I know is not what we're talking about right now, but and I hope she does some more. But yeah, as soon as I survive my Star Trek Continues shooting, it's time to go burrow back and see what's exactly up and see what's going.
That wasn't a spoiler alert. He meant filming everyone. His character will live on.
What'd I say? Oh,
shooting.
Yeah, especially since there's no film involved. Yeah. Gonna shoot McCoy. Yeah. So no, I'm sorry. I don't have any cool stuff. I'm glad to know I can talk about the Troy thing out loud though, but, yeah. I know what was funny was, at least as far as the documentary goes, was Rob Burnett was kind of freaking out because the first two or three years of Next Gen were all about, you know, settling in, getting it off the ground, the revolving door of writers, Michael coming in and having a crazy year and getting it settled. And then he was always like, well, it's going to be so boring now from, and I'm like, oh no, come on. You know better than that. He was like, comparatively speaking, the last half of the series is going to be so boring to talk about because it was, you know, all happy dappy. And I was like, no, it's not. And it's not. Chain of Command is sixth season, right?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
I believe so. Yeah.
Frank Abbatamarco was a writer that came in that was an Emmy nominated Emmy writer, was going to do big and his big project was Chain of Command, and he wanted to make a torture statement and do a good old fashioned, you know, Star Trek torture show. And he was one of the more famous of the ones that didn't. What did I say?
No, I just like that. I like the fact that that's a concept. Yeah, let's do a good old fashioned torture show for Star Trek.
A good old fashioned theme show. That's what I realized.
Wait a minute. Is this like a thing? Like, I don't know.
Well, next year.
I mean, they did one for Enterprise. These are the Voyages.
Because Jim is everyone's favorite original series episode, right? I mean, come on. A good old swing and hang 'em high show. No, a good old fashioned thematic show, a little morality play. Make a comment. And but he was a case of a writer that didn't fit. It's hard to write Star Trek, which is also why no one would ever use their Star Trek scripts as a spec script to any other normal 1 hour drama. Because it's like, okay. I mean, on one hand, if you wanted to write Star Trek, it was such a rarefied thing that you had to have that exact int to it. And if you that was your goal as a writer to get in that door and be there and be, you know, Ron Moore, Rene Echevarria, be Brandon Broderick. That was great. But if you were going to, you know, sell some scripts there and turn around and get on staff somewhere else, no one would care that you could. It's like, well, this is real good. Now, can you write real TV? And not that it's science fiction and they're snubbing their nose at a science fiction show or genre show. And this has probably changed in the last 10, 20 years also, because there's so many quirky shows on now that everything has its peccadilloes in format now. But at the time, it was kind of like, this is so rarefied that we just need you to write straight ahead drama where people can be friends one scene and hate each other in the next scene and come back. You know, we don't have to have external drama for conflict. So Frank Abbatamarco was one of the ones that he did his 13 weeks and didn't really work out. And you saw that happen all down. Perfectly good writers, award-winning writers. And that's one, you know, and here's the show is six seasons in and they're still having those kind of things pop up. And not that anybody enjoys that. It just kind of throws things where you're all, oh, good, we've got so-and-so coming in. This will be great. Have a new injection of some fresh blood. And then it's, you know, not. So he worked and worked and worked on his Chain of Command Part 2. And it got made. And, I'm you know, all the polishing happened with everybody on staff after he did his research to try to bring the issues out that he wanted to bring. But that's one thing I hope. They've had so much freedom. Nobody has a job to protect and a franchise to protect now. It's really been refreshing what they've done with the commentaries and with the documentary. And I'm very envious because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was doing the book, when we did Communicator, you still couldn't say that, or you couldn't get people to say that on camera. And even watching Brandon and Rick talk about Enterprise now has been really, you know, and I think good for fandom too, and in history in general. And Mark Cushman's books are going to be amazing too, just getting facts out. But that's what, you know, that's what distance does, and that's what statute of limitations does. So the sixth season is as boring as it feels. There's still some good textury tales to tell, and, you know, people banging heads over things in a creatively different way, differences way. So that's what I'm looking forward to, Chris.
Yeah, the extras have been great on all the Blu-rays, and especially the Enterprise ones, just because we didn't know as much about that series. But I've also enjoyed seeing the little things that they've cleaned up in the episodes. And when I was watching Relics, I was just watching also to see where is something that I think they might remaster to clean it up and it might look better. And the two things that stuck out for me were the when they have the solar flare on the view screen. I kind of had a feeling that's probably something that's going to end up having to be replaced. And then the Janolan's shields when they're holding open the Dyson sphere, like that's that effect, I was thinking perhaps. Did you guys say, Daniel, did anything stand out to you that you want to see them remaster in this episode? Oh,
nothing in particular. Like I said, I've been going through a rewatch of the series and just getting into season six, or actually, well, just had been getting into season five and then into season six. It's so strikingly jarring to go from the Blu-rays to the standard definition. Like, I'm just excited to see it in general in HD. Like, it's so hard to watch these episodes now in standard definition. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm sure I'm missing so much cool stuff.
Well, I think for the remastered part of this, for Relics, will they have to remaster the original series bridge scene of the planet because they use the original planet view instead of the remastered original series planet view where it actually looks like a planet?
Actually, when Scotty walks into the holodeck, I'm sure they'll remaster that as well. Actually, now that you mentioned that, because you can kind of tell it was green screened or whatever they did. It looks like a painting or whatever, but like I hope that they'll kind of clean that up a little bit, because it looks fake when he first gets in there, because it shows the whole bridge and you know it's just a still or whatever it is that's going on.
Yeah, since actually it was a loop, but since they've now remastered in Blu-ray'd the original series, you're right. They'll probably go get that 6 seconds from this side of paradise when Kirk walked on the bridge and it was empty. That's what they used. And they'll probably get that Blu-ray remastered and put it in and have it rematted in. And
it's just some good old fashioned Star Trek time travel editing.
Yeah. Daniel, it was just interesting hearing you talk about, and I know exactly what you mean about the quantum leap, even just from the DVDs, the Blu-rays, but, just thinking what a revelation it was going to the DVDs from the old washed out VHS copies when.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking about this with somebody the other day. It was so amazing. I mean, we've had so many compressions of technology change followed quickly by what consumers will pay for. And it was almost like the Dyson Sphere in Relics. Trials and tribulations, part of what was cool there was everybody seeing the original footage so clean and pristine and cleaned up, when you weren't watching all the cool CGI, the plot of the DS9 plot and then the intermarriage of the DS9 people with the original series films and footage, and it was tribbles and it was it's so wonderfully, it's sentimental and everybody loved it. But every once in a while, there's a little piece of your brain clicked in. You went, holy Toledo, look at them walk in the K7 bar. It's just the straight footage and it looks cool, because they went and they had to match. And they had to go pull a negative and do a new positive. And everybody on the crew was standing around watching this monitor going, Jesus Christ, would you look at this? It's like it's NBC 1967 or watching it prime time on my new RCA. But at the time, all anybody had seen had been the washed out, TV reruns. And then when they did the first VHS tapes, they didn't go into any big trouble. I mean, they did a little bit, but they just went and got positives and made copies of the positives that were already not totally great, but they were just like, people were just so in love with being able to have a tape at home. That was the thing. It was just having, not time shifting, but you could go watch a Star Trek episode anytime you wanted. That was the appeal. And so here it is. It's just 90. We're not talking 1960, 78 or so. This was 96. And people are having little, wet dreams over seeing this, standing around on stage watching this episode and saying, God, we had to spend so much to do this new positive from an old negative. It was worth it because we had to match lighting and colors. And we couldn't have like crappy, it's like building a fresh walls on a bad foundation. You had to start, from square one. And to think that within less than 10 years, they'd already gone back and said, oh, yes, we should go back and strike a new positive from the negative. Yeah. Go back to the negative and do the new. Oh, and by the way, it'll be DVD digital. It won't just be, film grain. And we'll do all this stuff. And now already, the DVDs aren't good enough. Now we all want them to be the HD. And we're going to see where the coffee stain is. And we're going to see, every little flaw in the paint job on the wall. And it's just, we're talking about like 10, 15, 20 years, and we've gone through three generations already of the technology and the expectation that everybody has. Anyway,
I think we should
That just kills
me. I think
me.
We should all just hold out for the 4K releases. They're coming out in like three, 4 years.
Can they even do that? So. I mean, can you pull a 4K out of build? I don't think it's possible, but I would pay lots of money.
That's what they always say.
Scotty could do it.
Well, I saw in the store down the street from my house here, they have the Indiana Jones trilogy, I believe, available on discs as 4K.
What?
And I haven't seen it, but I saw the box on the shelf.
And you saw a 4K. Well, maybe you don't have a TV to purchase it on. But
no, I don't have a TV, but the box itself, right. It has 4K.
I'm saying, like, if I saw Indiana Jones in 4K, I would buy it immediately. I would be like, okay, give that to me. I will watch all of them. Except for the
who cares?
They were actually excavating for a new parking structure in Hollywood, and they came across an ancient temple from 1984, and they found where this alien had left behind a 4K edition.
We don't talk. And
they were totally broke into this temple burial ground and plumbed all of the relics out of it.
And then everyone gathered around. They wanted to see it. They opened the case of the 4K release, and then they all melted.
Well, they found out the code was you had to take it inside the Egyptian theater and hold it at a certain place and rerun the original, analog projector with a digital lighting enabled. And when you mix the two technologies at just the right point on the apex of the solar – oh, forget it. Okay.
And the aliens had some kind of skull structure. Yeah.
Scotty would be so proud of you right now, Larry. Scotty would say, that is an amazing little piece of reasoning there, Mr. Image.
Yeah. And it leapfrogged the technology 2,000 years.
All right. Well, we've been talking about relics and other related topics now for about an hour, so a little over an hour. So let's wrap up with final thoughts. Philip, do you have any final thoughts on the episode or...
Yeah, well, I mean,
anything about Scotty?
Yeah, I mean, Relics was just a great... I mean, it's not even just fan service. It was just a good episode. Because if I say fan service, you feel like you can just throw it all away. But no, it was a good episode in and of itself. Like, the little bits of, like, where on the ship when Scotty beamed in using the original series effects and sound effects. I'm like, I don't... We know the ship is a little older than that. But still, who cares? But, I mean, it's a great episode. And the whole theme of, the being older versus the being younger and finding ways to be useful. I mean, it's a universal theme. I mean, I'm so young, I don't get it, right? But,
that's my
idea. But I'm trying to stick with it. I'm faking it. It's just a great overall episode between, Picard and Scotty and LaForge, and just a great episode overall. I think I would give it one missing Troy, which is about 10. So,
you have a weird scale.
I knew someone was going to give it a missing Troy. How about you, Daniel?
I mean, it's not a perfect episode by any means. I have a big problem with the fact that the Enterprise D is like known as the diplomatic shuttle, like from place to place, and yet they have a problem being nice to someone who's important. Like, they're really mean to this living legend, and it's like, look, you on a weekly basis you transport dignitaries and you give them all of your attention, and then this living legend shows up on your ship and you can't give him, like, even the ensign is too busy to stay with Scotty. He's like, oh, if you have any problems, just talk to the computer because I'm not worried about it. I've got to go, scrub something or something. It's like, what? Like, whatever. I don't know. So there, it's not a perfect episode, but I really enjoy it. I love it a lot, actually. And it is cool. I love the scenes. I love to see Picard on the original series bridge. I don't know. Like, that's like a, maybe it's like a, something's wrong with my brain where I'm like, whoa, this is so cool. This is like crossing the streams. But I love that kind of stuff. So I would give it, eight bottles of Aldebaran whiskey.
Sounds good. Larry, do you have anything to add?
No, it's just that we get caught up in the rush of things, and to stop and think and remember that Relics was not only cool in the day for the landmark that it was, and as much ballyhoo as Unification the year before it had with Spock, because Spock had been, short of Kirk, Spock had been the ooh. Because people knew that Spock could very well be alive 100 years later, whereas everyone else, we saw McCoy be 137. But everyone else, you kind of had the idea, what would that happen? And even after the Nimoy-Spock episode, the fact that you could have this much excitement with Scotty just kind of re-engineered, reinvigorated, reminded everyone of the affection that people had for the character and that they got Jimmy when he was still capable of actually pulling it off. But also that this is, on the other hand, it's almost like you look back now and you see this is almost like the beta run, the trial run for all of the cool shows to come down the line over the years when they would go back and revisit this, like we were saying earlier. And it's like, it's almost like the little baby steps of, can we get away with this? Can we afford to do that? Can we can we do this with the set? Can we do this visually? Can we get so-and-so? And it's all these, and can I put this in a script? And can I have him talk about, can we put in his birth year? Can we make these homages to the Dolmen of Elas? And can we do this? And will we have people from our next-gen audience go, what the hell is he talking about when he did? You know, because their numbers were so much huger than any group that had ever watched the original series and still is. So just thinking about, like, this is the first of all the fun, you know, original series or the fun, goofy gimmick shows to come back. It's kind of interesting and kind of remembering to look at it in that way. And one little goofy thing that took me a few viewings to watch is when they're on the Janola and they're wandering around that little combo set and some of the accoutograms up on the wall, they were kind of in a pinch, I guess, or maybe it was a last minute thing. But it's interesting to see how that little bitty ship, the Janolan, that little transport ship, their warp core is exactly the same size and shape and diameter and mass as a Galaxy Class's warp core. If you look at there's one accoutogram where it's just the standard one pulled off the D and plopped up there. And it was kind of like, wow, okay, there's a 7/8 of that ship is taken up with the warp core, which may have been why they were able to pull off the transport thing for 75 years, I guess, comparatively speaking. Yeah. But anyway, no, it's a great show.
They diverted 7/8 of the ship's resources to storing Scotty's pattern, right?
I give this show 4 Franklins. It's a great, or 5, 5 Franklins. It's a great,
5 Franklins.
Yeah. All alas, right. Poor Ben.
That's only 50% of the Franklins though.
Yeah. Good show.
Well, for me, I always enjoy this episode, even though, you know, they have to come up with an idea. How are we going to get somebody? As you were saying, Larry, Spock is really the only person from the original series who could actually live this long. So they have to come up with some other trick to get them on. But, you know, the idea of rigging up a transporter to save yourself fits Scotty. I mean, because that's what he did all through the original series, is find a way. What does he tell LaForge? He tells him, like, I spent my entire career thinking up crazy ways to do things. And so it fit him perfectly. And I thought they did a really good job of paying homage to the original series and very respectful of Scotty's character in the story. So it worked really well for me. And again, now as I watch it, As I'm much older than I was when it first came on, of course, I pick up on more of the, you know, Scotty trying to come to terms with the present and then his past, which are things I didn't pay attention when it aired when I was in university. So I really enjoy this episode, and I'm just going to give it 1 industrial strength pattern buffer, which is a really good rating.
Yes. Don't make them like they used to.
Nope.
All right. Well, Philip and Daniel, thanks so much for staying up very late where you are to join us today. And Philip, before we go, tell everyone where they can find you, of course, on the network and around the internets.
Sure. Yeah, of course. They can find Daniel, myself, and Darren Moser on Earl Grey talking about all things The Next Generation, coincidentally. But they can find me on Twitter, and my handle is NCPublicServant. And they can find some of my Next Generation article musings on Trek.fm.
Excellent. And how about you, L. Danbaran, as your screen name says tonight? Where can people find you?
Yeah, well, as Philip says, I am on the TNG show Earl Grey. So you can find us there every week talking everything TNG, including Relics at some point, I'm sure. And on Twitter, my handle is 1UpDan. That is the number 1, not the word.
See, Larry, he tries to 1-up people in Twitter. That's his...
Succeeds. Ah. I succeed at 1-upping people, is what he meant to say. Yeah. See? Like, just that, right there. That was a 1-up right there.
Like, let's play who's the youngest. Oh, Daniel, you 1-upped us.
Hashtag 1-up.
Oh, exactly. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Well, Larry, that was a really interesting discussion about relics. It's always great when you're on the show with us because you have all the interesting behind-the-scenes tidbits that we don't all get. And unfortunately, not everything that's in your brain has been transcribed to memory alpha yet. That's coming one day, I know, but not yet.
Yeah, I've managed to hang on to 2% of it or something, whatever. I say that with all the love to our memory alpha guys. They did a great job.
So, oh yeah, Memory Alpha is a great resource that's there, but so much of the information is from books and such, and it's great to get insider tidbit information though, which is one of the wonderful things about podcasting and being able to talk to you and others who have been around the show, worked on the show, and stuff over the years.
Well, that's what's great about doing the On Speaker series is I'm going back and listening to some of the source interview things that I made my notes from a long time ago and didn't always transcribe, and I get into things that, or I come across the things that are, I shouldn't have said that. Can you not include that? Okay. They're there.
Right.
So that's kind of fun.
I'm not supposed to let that out of the bag. Yeah. Well, relics is not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. We've talked about many other parts of the Star Trek universe, so here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
Looking for Parmok in all the wrong places.
Well, and you also get the feeling here that she's only... Worf really is only being rejected because she's not interested. It has nothing to do with whether or not Worf is Klingon enough or any of that. She's just not interested. She's interested in Quark.
Earl Grey.
The holodeck.
Alexander Rozhenko was conceived on the holodeck.
That's exactly right. In Worf's calisthenics program, with Skeletor watching, because he was just frozen there and he couldn't look away.
The Ready Room.
The Man Trap.
Well, it wasn't what Roddenberry wanted to do with it. It was what the writer George Clayton Johnson wanted to do with it. But it was basically making the character more sympathetic.
To the journey!
The Doctor.
But I love that moment when Chakotay was projecting himself into the room. And he totally kneels down and gets super serious and calm like Chakotay does. He's like, what you've shown us is it's not what you're made of, but what you do or how you feel. He just started getting even in season two, they start to realize the Doctor is not just a hologram. He is becoming something more. Commentary, Trek stars.
Caprica.
Prequels are sort of a constant trap that people end up going to. This thing was successful and it ended. Well, let's go before it ended and tell a different story.
Warp 5.
Klingons on Enterprise.
Having the Klingons at the very beginning of the series running through that field, do you think that was born out of the discomfort that the studio had in the idea of the prequel series to begin with?
Trek News and Views.
The Naked Time.
Gold shirts are easily ripped and disposable.
Yeah.
Blue shirts self-replicate so that they, show no damage. And red shirts whisk away sweat.
Yeah, they're highly absorbent.
There you go.
So that you can't tell that your security guards are nervous.
Literary Treks.
David R. George III, Revelation and Dust.
And it feels like an evolution for Starfleet as well in the way that they built a starbase.
Well, I'm glad that came across because that was sort of one of the things that I was going for. You want it to be an evolution in Starfleet's construction of star bases. Mm-hmm. It should be something brand new. And because it's an important station, because it's in an important location, it really needed to be, I thought, a grand station.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of those shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can stream or download from the website, and you'll find links to everything at trek.fm/pd for podcast directory.
Wow, Chris, that just makes me realize, that we did Stellar Tartography, the new Matt book set, that I forgot to include the Trek FM Empire on the layout of the major galactic governments there. I'll have to do that in the second edition, I guess.
Yeah, if I remember the discussion you and I had about that book on Literary Treks, I think the Trek of Film is located right down near Cardassia in the Caribbean.
Yes. So, a little bit,
check that out.
A little bit south of the Gulf Stream or whatever it was, yeah.
That's right. All right. Well, another thing, Larry, we've been very fortunate here at Trekafilm to get a lot of reviews on iTunes from people who are enjoying the shows. And we have a new review since the last time we did the Ready Room 2 weeks ago. And this is from Section 47. And this was on the US iTunes store. And Section 47 says Trek Fix, and it gives us five stars, cool. Which must be a reference to me always saying, get your daily Trek Fix. But Section 47 says, thank you, the Ready Room, for helping me get my Trek Fix. I love the format of the show and the excellent production quality. I love the mix of guests and appreciate the range of conversation from lighthearted banter to serious in-depth analysis. A rich show for a rich universe. Keep up the great work. P.S. Could you explain the origin of the barrel roll and the other side of the room? Thanks again. All right. So the barrel roll is, now the barrel roll itself originates from the old Nintendo game Star Fox, but in our case, the barrel roll is a reference to how Geordi would escape a warp core breach by rolling underneath the blast door as it came down by doing a barrel roll. And at recent conventions, LeVar Burton has actually done a barrel roll on the stage.
The Under the Ice. That started attending. With the game? Because a barrel roll was just an aviation maneuver when your plane would do a barrel roll.
Well, that's what in Star Fox, when you're flying the spaceship as Star Fox, you would do a barrel roll in the game and it would have do a barrel roll. And
okay,
so
okay. I was going to say.
That's where that particular one comes from, and we use the sound clip.
Oh, okay. Okay. And I was going to say, I think it predates,
but it's reference to Geordi.
Video game. I think it would have been before, but I get it.
Yeah, the term itself does. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and then Geordi.
So that's a barrel roll. And also, the other side of the room is when we record the Ready Room, we also talk a lot before the show or after the show, which you guys listening don't hear because it's not actually in the show. Some of it's not in the show because it's not really appropriate for all audiences.
And, well, it's the hellos and chatter and people sign on and they're getting their gab out of the way.
All kinds of stuff going on.
Getting warmed up.
That's right. So that's the other side of the room. And at some point we started referring to, we were talking about this on the other side of the room. And then Larry, you were on, it was quite early on, and we mentioned it, and you said,
the other side of the room.
And ever since then, that sound clip is spliced into the Ready Room.
Oh,
every
the,
time someone
the
says,
movie announcer
the other
voice?
Side of the room.
The movie.
Yes.
Well, that comes from, I hope everybody knows, that comes that when Star Wars in 77 would play, the movie that I went to see it, there was a twin theater, and the movie on the other side was this romance called The Other Side of Midnight. And when I would hear you guys say The Other Side of the Room, I just remembered that movie because you'd be sitting in Star Wars for the 19th time, and the trailer would come on for The Other Side of Midnight. And I just said that, and apparently I struck a cultural nerve with you people. And there you go.
It's great. It's a very popular sound clip here.
Oh, okay.
Dream. So Section 47, that's the origin, and we thank you for your great review. And for everyone else, if you enjoy the show, please drop by iTunes and leave us a star rating and a written review. It does help other Star Trek fans find the Ready Room as they search for Star Trek podcasts in the iTunes store, so we really appreciate that. And also, if you'd like to contact us and share your thoughts about today's show, there are a variety of ways you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. There's also a tab on the website that you can click and send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone. Or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to join in the discussion with us and other listeners about the show. And social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek. Now, Larry, what if people want to find you, keep up with what you've got coming up, what you're doing? Where's the best place for them to go?
Well, the basic place is my Larry Nemechek's Trek Land on Facebook, larrynemechek.com. The blog is treklandblog.com. It's been a little beleaguered lately. I'm going to gear up as soon as we finish filming Star Trek Continues here in the next couple of weeks. We start Tuesday, but I'll be back from it in a couple of weeks. And on Twitter, I'm at Larry Nemechek. And within that domain, theconofwrath.com is there, and our Trekland on Speakers CDs, now with our second disc out, which you do the art design and the remastering for. Thank you again. and we just made the big push with the second disc. And the Trekland trunk we've talked about happening. And we're gearing up for another Trek to Vegas, or LA to Vegas Star Trek tours next summer in August with Geek Nation Tours, our film site tour. And, geez, lots of stuff. And I need to mention that Star Trek Continues is doing a Kickstarter. We're at 41%, and we're not halfway through yet, so that's been great. We're raising money for 3 episodes at Kickstarter. So if you're if you go to Star Trek Continues or official Star Trek Continues on Facebook, you can find out about that. And I hope everybody goes over. We've had a ton of we've had so many great fans there, and that's been kind of great. And there's and their donors there are getting bloopers and a lot. They're doing a lot of content. And then 2 or 3 days later, the bloopers are coming out. And I know we're all involved with some. They've done some with Todd as Spock and Vic as Kirk, and they've told me there's a Larry as Bones, and I think I know even the scene. I think there's one scene where I was just wiped out, and I did like one line 15 times, yeah. And I think that's going to be my blooper. So I'm already kind of braced for it. But anyway, it's been a lot of fun, and that's in my face. And when I get back, I promise everybody I will get my stuff up at the trunk and some of the other things going too. So it's been a wild year for me. Sounds and great. Wild year for everybody, and we'll see what's going on. I have no conventions coming up till the spring, so that's clear on that end. But I was going to say Section 47. That's an awesome name. I love that. I started smiling the minute you said it. So good for them.
I thought you'd like that when I saw it. Yeah, like Larry's going to like this one. All right. Well, that sounds great. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as at my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And elsewhere on the network, you'll find me on Sundays with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where we talk Star Trek books and comics and interview authors. And on Wednesday, in addition to the Ready Room here, you'll find me with Matthew on The Orb, where we talk Deep Space Nine. And then on Fridays, I'm with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And I also have my interview show, Matter Stream, which comes out occasionally. It's not a weekly show, but I have a few new episodes on there recently as well, so you can go check that out as well. Also, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website portfolio, or as we discussed with the commerce feature, an online store. Create your own space today or your own store. I promise you're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and use offer code TREK10 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And don't forget to choose that annual plan and get the free custom domain registration as well. Also, don't forget to check out the future of Star Trek Combadge technology at zoe.me/trekfm. Find out more about the device, see photos, and watch for the launch of the Zoe Kickstarter campaign. There's also a YouTube video that they've put together showing how Zoe compares to Siri, for example, which you may be familiar with, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so you can check that out. So remember to include the Trek FM portion of the URL when you visit so Zoe knows that you heard about it here on the show. And again, that's at zoe.me, that's xowi.me/TrekFM. And we really thank Zoe for their support of the Ready Room. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the show, there's a way you can do that by going to trek.fm/donate, where we have 8 original alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. These include Borg, Klingon, and Dorians, and many more, and they're available as both badges and art prints. You can mix and match, choose which aliens you want in which style, and we have different levels of donation that you can make, and you'll find it all at trek.fm/donate. We'd like to thank Gary Lum and Daniel Handlin, who donated this past week. Their contributions like yours help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the Ready Room and our other shows to you each week. So again, go check out those aliens at trek.fm/donate. Well, Larry, I'm going to go wander back through the ship here. I'm just dying to know where Troy has been all this time, because I don't know, I feel sorry for Scotty. I think he could have used
her
help.
That's great. I'm going to stick a Sydney-class transport in it because the Ready Room is done.